Here we go again.
It's time to talk.
I thought it was April Fool's Day when I heard that one. Get me off the air before I have a heart attack. We will have nothing to see for it. There's been many false dawns.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
The kindness of Cork people will never let you down.
Conversation that matters.
And be part of those conversations. The Neil Prendeville Show with Mercedes-Benz Cork. So one of the red tops this morning, the Star says, Bank Hottie Day. Bank Hottie Day. I don't know about the hot part of it, but certainly good bright spells of sunshine right across the bank holiday. It'll be worth it when the rain clears, they're saying in the papers this morning. Meanwhile, the one story dominating many of the front pages, not just here, but over in the UK as well. And that is Rwanda, Northern Ireland, the Irish border, and refugees and international protection order applicants and migration in general across the border between us, the open border between us and Northern Ireland. Like, for instance, the English Times this morning is saying over half of the migrants who are set to go to Rwanda are now officially missing. More than 5,700 migrants have been identified for removal, but only just over 2,000 of them have actually been accounted for. So where did they go? Could one suggest that 80% of them, as the government has been saying, and as Helen McEntee has been saying, have come into the Republic via Northern Ireland. Now, big day today for the Irish Cabinet, because they're all sitting down to meet. The front of the Irish Times this morning says that the Cabinet is expected to back and pass, I suppose, or try and get it through, because it would be emergency legislation, to transfer to the United Kingdom asylum seekers who have arrived here through Northern Ireland. Now, we know that Rishi Sunak is having none of it. He says the UK will not accept them. But how would you send them back? I mean, think about it, really. Is it a case of you bus people back to Belfast and then, what, they get a ferry or they fly back themselves? Or do we fly people back to the UK from Dublin? And then what if they're refused entry at Heathrow or Gatwick? I mean, how is this going to work? And if it's Belfast, what's stopping people who wish to have a life in Ireland coming back down over the border again? We will send refugees back to the UK. Front page are making the Mirror today. Rishi won't accept them. Big standoff. A lot of tension on this one. Rish, you were here is the headline making the Star today. Sunak won't take back asylum seekers who have fled to Ireland. McEntee to push new laws, but the UK won't take them back, is the front making this morning's Independent. So it's interesting to see where this one is going. The Examiner carries it as well. Tensions escalate over refugee return. Ministers criticising Helen McEntee over her failure to ever even get a grip on the migration situation. So we'll come back to this a little later on this morning. Do get involved in that conversation. How does this get resolved, lads? Text 0868 104 106. And because there's a lot of statistics and numbers and percentages involved in this. So more on that in a little while. The front of the Echo today talks on its front page of a manslaughter verdict for two young men. They've now been convicted of the unlawful killing of 29-year-old Matt O'Neill in Carrigaline. Not sentenced yet, but they will be sentenced for the manslaughter on the 16th of May and have been remanded in custody until then. More on this in a few minutes' time with Barry Roach from the Irish Times. In other news stories then, big moves in the UK. I still don't know how they're going to do this. They're saying in the UK that nobody under the age of 13 will ever be able to smoke a cigarette in the UK. I'd love somebody could unpick that for me and work out how that's going to happen. But, well, they do want people not to smoke, and they want ultimately to ban tobacco. You know what happens then, that goes into the black market and smuggling becomes rife, but it is bad for you. And I suppose that vast majority of people, I mean, really, really, the very high percentage of people would say who smoke that they wish they never ever had their first cigarette. I imagine there are some who enjoy it and don't regret it, but it's in many cases, the vast majority would say, no, I wish I never did. But the Examiner this morning, Owen English, has a story saying that there is a move now to ban the sale of tobacco to under 21s. I imagine that not many people would have a problem with that. And again, it would always be self-policing, really, because, you know, if a 15-year-old wants to get a fag or light up a cigarette, they will do it, whether they buy it themselves or other people buy it for them. And then there's a very tragic story. This is kind of interesting because I got an email Do you remember the mass killing in Australia there a couple of weeks ago? Awfully, awfully sad. And the man who was responsible for that and was subsequently killed at the scene was said to have schizophrenia. I got an interesting email about a week ago, and I wanted to get it to air, wondering, you know, could something like that ever happen here with regards to people who are either diagnosed or not diagnosed? And I was reminded of that this morning with the CCTV footage that was released showing a hardened criminal by the name of Lee Byer. And that still from that CCTV, and he's all tooled up with gloves with blood on them and everything, fleeing the scene where he stabbed an Irish old age pensioner. And the Irish OAP was in his mobility scooter. It's a story that's picked up by the Irish Mirror today because he was only released from jail 5 days earlier from prison. He served a 12-year sentence for leading a robbery gang. And he suffered from paranoia, suffered from delusions, admitted manslaughter of an elderly Irish man by the name of Thomas O'Halloran, who had a dreadful death in his mobility scooter. Thomas, the grandfather, was originally from Clare. He was so well loved in the community in London, and he loved busking for charity, and that's what he did. He was an 87-year-old man, so he wanted to give back, and he would busk. A lot of it was Irish music, a lot of it was traditional, and he was very, 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 very popular. Found with multiple stab wounds in his mobility scooter back in 2022. So this guy had only been freed from jail days before he randomly turned on the pensioner. The papers also talk of assault of nurses. And there's over 4,000 nurses now have been assaulted on the job in just over a year. That's hard to take in, isn't it? 4,000 Irish nurses assaulted while at work in just over a year. How do we know this? Well, because the INMO are having their annual conference at the moment, and one of the figures that's quite interesting is that, or one of the comments that was made by Phil Nihay on this says that conditions in which our members are working, particularly when overcrowded, creates a pressure cooker type environment leading to more assaults. She couldn't put it any more straightforward than that. And the papers also today talk of other issues regarding hospitals. And you know, in the ever-changing world that we live in, where they talk about unisex toilets more. Now, this could be in the workplace in general. This could be in social settings. This could be in classrooms and schools. Or it could be in hospitals. Well, there's a study released now, and it's a story that makes this morning's Independent. And the headline says, hospital unisex toilets pose infection risk because men are less likely to wash their hands. That's news to me that they have statistics out to prove that men wash their hands less than women when they use the bathroom or the toilet. But apparently this is what they're saying. It might save on space in overcrowded hospitals, but converting male and female toilets to unisex will probably increase the risk of infection and cross-infection because men are less likely to wash their hands. And what would be spread? Well, bacteria, fungi, drug-resistant superbugs, E. coli, on the floor, on the ceilings, on the door handles, any of the surfaces of hospitals that will be touched. It's a survey that was done in the UK, but it would stand up here. Can't imagine that men in the UK wash their hands any more or less than Irishmen, but that's news to me. What do you make of that? Text 0868104106. And this is an interesting one. I like to keep an eye on the Workplace Relations Committee hearings and tribunals. This one isn't an Irish one, but it is an English one from the London Times today. And you'll recall Julia Roberts, the Hollywood sex worker. She might have, they say prostitute in this morning's English Times. I didn't know that that was a term that was still being used, but anyway, they use it. She might well have objected, she might well have not objected to being called a pretty woman, which is a film actually that I got to get around to seeing at some stage. But there was a tribunal recently where the judge ruled that suggesting that a woman's looks might help a business is not flattering and is actually diminishing to the woman. The judge added that it was unlikely that the term would be applied to a man in the workplace, you know, that you're pretty or you're good looking. But anyway, here's a quick summation of what the story is. It involved an accounts manager at a vehicle recovery firm. She sued her employers after being told to attend a meeting because a male client liked pretty women. Now, she was humiliated and she was undermined when her boss extended the invitation purely because of her physical appearance. She quit her job, £60,000 a year job, and is now in line for receiving compensation because you just can't say that. You just can't. It's not acceptable. And nobody should accept that kind of language, that kind of demeaning language. So it's right, don't you think? I believe anyway, 100%. It was right that she should get a payout, and I think it should be very substantial, seeing as it led to her quitting her job. I want you to come to this meeting with me because the client likes pretty women. Even shudder thinking about it. Another thing that you'd shudder about, and I kind of love these stories because for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, water was not safe to drink. So what people did is they drank beer. Now, it was much weaker beer than the beer we drink now. It would have been nowhere near the 4 or the 5%, more likely to be 1% or 2%. So you could drink more of it. And I suppose right up to, I don't think it's acceptable anymore in the UK, but for many years, like hundreds of years, people in the, you have to see it in Coronation Street, and you'd see it in EastEnders and stuff like that, going in to the pub, whether it was the Rover's Return or the Old Vic or the Queen Vic or whatever it was called, for a couple of pints at lunchtime. Not acceptable anymore, but it was very acceptable when the Egyptians were building the pyramids, because food historians, story from this morning's Mirror today, have revealed that they treated booze or beer like food, and that those that built the pyramids, and they built them rightly straight and everything, in spite of the fact that they were drinking a gallon of beer a day, they would sink 10 pints a day. Clearly now, you know, not five or six knock the head off you, but still 10 pints of it nonetheless. Apparently, the main reason, of course, down through the centuries, was because water would kill you. Some of the time it was so bad. And, you know, dirty water, bad news. And we spoke about it yesterday on the air, and I'll have more calls with people whose water is the colour of coffee or the water is the colour of tar. But if, for instance, you do like to shower or wash or keep the house clean, it's an interesting update in The Sun this morning as to how, I know I mentioned this a couple of months ago, how long you should keep different things in the home before you throw them out. Interestingly, they're saying that if you have towels and you're using them regularly, 3 months, I don't know how you'd remember, you write it on the towel, throw out after 3 months. Keep the towels for 3 months. The curtain shower has to go after 6 months because of all sorts of bacteria in it. But did you know that you shouldn't keep your pots and pans longer than 3 years? I pass it on for what it's worth. The toilet brush has the shortest life of all. I mean, how many people actually throw out the toilet brush after 8 weeks? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. Rugs, 3 year life, get rid of them. One thing that we haven't caught on to what an awful lot of other countries do around the world is taking your shoes off at the front door. Some societies would be absolutely horrified if you walked into their home and walked in the hallway with your shoes on. We don't, by and large, go along with that. Sure, we don't. So rugs after 3 years, but even something that's used, I mean, okay, something that's used all of the time, multiple times a day, all day, every day. What is it? Your phone. So they're saying your phone cover needs to go every 6 months. Incidentally, the papers also talk about Bruce Springsteen is going to play all sorts of gigs, including on Leaside. He plays Porky Cueve in Cork on the 16th of May. And when you add up all of the Bruce Springsteen gigs, he will play to 1 million fans over 40 years coming to Ireland. This summer run will bring him to over 1 million fans. Bruce is on fire in more ways than one.
Call Neil now. 0818 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Get involved in the conversation. Text 0868 104 106. Just one update though. Do you know how about a week or 10 days ago, might have been closer to a fortnight ago, Drew Harris decided that every single member of An Garda Síochána in a uniform would have to spend 30 minutes of each shift engaging in high visibility road policing. That's having already a huge impact because of this 30 minute order of every single shift has to be 30 minutes at least on the roads. The reason I say that is because the number of people caught using mobile phones in the first 12 days of the directive is up 60% already. And if the message goes out that there's more of a chance of being caught, of course, it probably will keep people safer on the roads. Those on the phones, the morons, and those that they could crash into and injure or kill. So you see how things work when you have visible policing or visible presence of An Garda Síochána. So that's got to be good news. Meanwhile, very bad traffic heading eastbound on the N20. There's a man stuck by Corraheen and hasn't moved for a while this morning, so bear that in mind. I don't know what the backup is, but it certainly is delaying people. So, can I cast your minds back to December the 28th, 2022, if you don't mind, because there were two different court cases that came to a conclusion this week at the Central Criminal Court sitting in Cork. It involved Ricardo Hoey and Jordan Deasy. And it was connected to the death of Matt O'Neill from Carrigaline on December 28th, 2022. Barry Roach is covering the story for the Irish Times this morning. He joins me by WhatsApp. Barry, good morning.
Good morning, Neil. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. And in both cases now, we have not guilty of murder, but guilty of manslaughter.
Yes, that's the situation. There were two accused. Ricardo Hoey, who's 21, he's from Carrig in Carrigaline, and Jordan Deasy, who's 19, he's from Ravensdale in Heronswood in Carrigaline, and they both denied the murder of Matt O'Neill, who was 29, at Glenwood Estate in Carrigaline on the 28th of December 2022. So it was at trial for the past two and a bit weeks at the Central Criminal Court sitting here in Cork, and on Thursday the jury came back. A jury of seven men and five women, no, six women and six men, my apologies, came back on Thursday after almost 15 hours of deliberation.
Weren't they very long deliberations, Barry?
Absolutely, yeah. I was trying to recall one that a new trial I've covered before that went that long, because it was, jury went out, let me think, was it Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday last week in the case of Jordan Deasy, and then they weren't sitting Friday, and then they went into yesterday. So, as I say, in Jordan Deasy's case, it was almost 15 hours before they came back with not guilty of murder, but guilty of manslaughter. And then Ricardo Hoey continued, the jury continued deliberating on his involvement until yesterday, and they were out for about an hour or so yesterday, and it just came in at just under, I think it's just under 18 hours. And in his case, again, they found him not guilty of murder, but guilty of manslaughter.
And how does this work? In this case, would you have two cases running alongside each other in the same court, is it? Explain that.
Yeah, they were co-accused, so they were ran together, and the evidence was given in respect of both of them simultaneously. But obviously the jury assessed each because there were different involvements, I suppose, in the sense that we heard that Jordan Deasy pushed and punched Matt O'Neill, and then we heard that Ricardo Deasy, when he was on the ground, kicked him once in the head. Ricardo Hoey, my apologies, pushed or kicked him once on the head when he was on the ground. So they assessed each of the accused separately, it would seem, and reached the verdict.
Okay.
Which is the correct way to go about it, and found Jordan Deasy not guilty after almost 15 hours of the not guilty of the murder after 15 hours deliberation, and then Ricardo Hoey not guilty of the murder after another 3 hours or so of deliberations.
And much of this, of course, would have been based on witnesses on that night.
Yeah, the actual incident itself wasn't witnessed, and there was no witness to that, but it was based on people who came upon the scene. They heard from a witness called John McGovern, or the jury did, who was walking through the estate about 7:30 when he came upon Mr. O'Neill on the ground in front of a car and two men over him. He said the car was stopped in the middle of the road. The car doors were open as far as they could. The taller man was on the driver's seat side. That would be Ricardo. The shorter man was on the passenger side. The third man was on the ground. I wasn't sure what I was after coming across. I asked, lads, what's after going on here? I approached the man on the ground, who I noticed was unconscious. He was on the passenger side. Only the taller man replied, and he said he wouldn't get out of the way. And I presumed the man on the ground would not get out of the way of the car. And he said, I noticed the evenness and calm of the man who answered. I marked it as strange. I would have expected them to be frantic. He, the taller man, was understated. Strangely together, the way he answered me, I told him I was going to call the Gardaí and the emergency services. And he said at that point, then their demeanour changed when he told them that he was calling the Gardaí and emergency services, as if he said it had dawned on them how Mr. O'Neill, who had cuts to his left temple, right ear and right hand, had come on to be on the ground, and they left the scene. The jury also heard evidence from an orthopaedic surgeon, Dr. Ron Sheehan. He's based in Tullamore, but he was visiting his parents in Carrigaline at the time, and he came across Mr. O'Neill unconscious on the ground, lying on his back with his arms and legs splayed, with blood visible on his teeth and from the back of his head. He said my initial thoughts were that he could have been knocked down, or could have fallen over, or he could have been assaulted, pushed over and fallen. It's very hard to say in the heat of the moment in the middle of the road, but he said he was pretty critically injured. You have this Glasgow coma scale. which medics use to assess people. And he said on that, he was at 3, the most critical level of the scale, measuring consciousness and impairment. His basic vitals, he said, were normal. He was breathing and his heart was beating. Heart and lungs were functioning, but he had a significantly bad head injury.
So this coma, the head injury, but this coma scale only goes to 3, is it? That's critical.
My understanding is, yeah. Okay. That's the most critical level. My understanding is that's the most critical level of it. While they were waiting, he said he was with him for an hour before and after the paramedics arrived, but that his condition deteriorated during that. And then he told Tom Creed, who was defending Ricardo, and Brendan Crane, who was defending Jordan DC, that Mr. O'Neill's head injury could have resulted from his head hitting the ground. They also heard from, there has been a previous incident, a man called Brian Kinnery, when he spotted Millie in the middle of the road. This was relating to a previous incident, which happened 4 days earlier. Part of the defence argument was that he may have sustained injuries in that previous incident 4 days earlier that were contributed to his death on the 28th. There was pathologist evidence in that, and I'll come to that in a moment. But there was a witness called Brian Kinnery who came across him in this previous incident, and there was a guy in the middle of the road, he said, with a guy in front of him and a guy behind him. They were digging him. I got out and wrote to them to get off him. One guy was kneeling down and they were throwing digs into his head, and one of the fellows said to him, "You've no idea what you're getting involved in." I helped Matt up. He said he didn't know he was Matt at that stage, but he's calling Matt now because he discovered since he was Matt O'Neill. I didn't know him at the time. He looked defenseless. He put his baseball hat back on. I put him into the car. I asked him where he lived, and I dropped him home. He was talking away good, he said. He helped him out of the car. I shook hands with him and he gave me a big hug. He went into his house. So he comes across as a very sort of vulnerable sort of character in that picture.
That was the earlier incident, the earlier incident. But I see in evidence that Jordan DC said he was a passenger, Ricardo Hoy was driving the car, and that Matt O'Neill was standing in front of the car, wouldn't get out of the way. They were beeping at him.
Yeah, that was a memo of interview that we heard from Jordan DC, which he gave to Detective in the Garda, Ian Breen. He said, as I said, Detective Garda Breen gave evidence in the memos with Jordan DC after he arrested him in a flat on New Year's Eve in Crosshaven. He said, "Me and Ricardo were driving in Glenwood. Matt O'Neill was standing in front of the car. He would not get out of the way of the car. He wouldn't move. We were telling him to move. He was waving his bottle. Ricardo was beeping first. He was swinging a bottle around by the windscreen. Ricardo pushed him. I hit him. He fell to the floor. Ricardo kicked him. I hit him when he was on the floor again. We got back into the car. I realized I dropped my phone and I went back out and got my phone." He was asked then about Mr. O'Neill falling and whether he hit his head, and replied, "He could have been on his head. I'm not sure. He was waving the bottle at us. I thought he was going to hit us with it. I just wanted to say to Matt, I did not mean for it to end up this way." He told Gardaí he did not mean to put the fiend, man into a coma. He was walking towards me with the bottle. Yeah. I hit him before he hit me. And then he was asked about Ricardo's kick on Mr. O'Neill, and he said it wasn't massive, but it wasn't hard either. It seemed hard. So a lot of this came down, I suppose, then with pathologists, with Dr. Margaret Bolster for the state, and she said Mr. O'Neill's fatal injuries resulted from blunt force trauma to the head, which she said was consistent with a combination of blows and a fall. But we heard then from a defence pathologist, Professor Jack Ray, he was in Northern Ireland, he was a pathologist there for many years, that he said that if Mr. O'Neill had suffered a small subdural hematoma from the earlier assault on Christmas Eve, he may have not shown any significant symptoms, as there would have been what he described as a lucid interval between the symptoms emerge. He said it's only when the blood clot enlarges that you have symptoms, and if someone is intoxicated when they're drowsy and their speech is slurred, these symptoms are very similar to what you get with subdural hematoma. He said there's a distinct possibility that there was bleeding already there. There is a likelihood of that, as opposed to the December 28th injury causing all the bleeding. He said the loss of consciousness appeared to develop rapidly on the 28th. That suggests to me there had been an earlier bleed.
Yeah.
He was cross-examined by prosecution Jane Counsel, or Jane Hyland, my apologies.
Yeah,
senior counsel. And she put Professor Crane that Dr. Bolster's findings was that the December 28th incident caused Mr. O'Neill's death, and he agreed that the second assault by the two defendants was a substantial contribution to his death. So the jury
had an awful lot to take on board, consider and deliberate over. Their choices would have been what? Guilty of murder, guilty of manslaughter, or not guilty?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, that was in respect of both defendants. They could have got one guilty of murder, one
Yes.
Not guilty of murder.
Yeah.
Both guilty of murder, both guilty of manslaughter, one not guilty of
any of those.
So there was a combination of verdicts. So it probably explains why they spent. And again, there was a lot of it coming down to the medical evidence and the fact, I suppose, that there had been an earlier incident as well. So that might well explain and
compounded the deliberations. Okay, so both guilty, both guilty of manslaughter, held in custody, I believe, awaiting probation reports and sentencing.
Yes, Ms. Justice Siobhan Langford, she thanked the jury for their diligence in what she described as a difficult trial and an emotional trial at times. Defence Counsel Tom Creed for Ricardo Hoy and Paul McCarthy for Jordan DC, they applied for the adjournment to allow for preparation of probation reports. The, Jane Hyland for the state had already said victim impact statements were ready from Matt O'Neill. He's the only son or the only child of Pat and Eileen O'Neill, and that his parents had already prepared a victim impact statement and how his death in such circumstances had affected them. So that was ready for the court yesterday.
When would we hear that? Is that at sentencing? Or
that's, that'll be at sentencing, right. And it's been adjourned to allow for the probation reports in the case of both Ricardo Hoy and Jordan DC, and then a governor's report from the prison on Jordan DC, because he's been in custody since he was charged back in early 2023. So it's been adjourned for those to be prepared to May the 16th. So that's 2 weeks' time, approximately.
Thank you so much, Barry. As always, much obliged to Barry Rhodes, Southern correspondent with the Irish Times. Manslaughter verdict for both back in court on May 16th. Text 0868104106. Back after the break.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
Text 0868104106. Oh, listen, in lighter news, a big shout out. I got an email in from Southern California there yesterday from Ray and Sean. I pass it on now because otherwise I'll just forget. You have injured us. We're two Cork boys, one in California, one in Southern California. I spent 50 hours learning how to record, edit and launch our new podcast. What a dose. But it's done now and we're proud of it. It's called The Irishman Podcast. And we're more than proud. We'd love to get more Cork listeners. Will you give us a shout out? Subject line is mainly having the crack and talking a few things Irish. Thanks, Neil. Keep up the good work, says Ray and Sean. So one's in California enjoying the sunshine and the other in Southern California equally enjoying the sunshine. And they got a new podcast out now called The Irishman Podcast. Go check it out. But not while I'm on the air. Check it out later on. Meanwhile, on issues involving the tension between us and the UK now, interesting texts on this. Good morning, Neil. If the French were doing their job, then the Irish would not have a problem with people coming from Northern Ireland seeking international protection. They can get on a bus, come to Belfast via Cairn Ryan without a passport. We can put these people seeking international protection back on the boat to the UK. We can't, because it's against EU law. If the boats were going the other way, I don't think too many would land on French soil, says Coleman of Westcott. Point being, the UK are standing their ground because they say, well, the French don't reciprocate for us when we're trying to send migrants or people coming over to the UK back from the beaches. Isn't it very worrying now for people in the government? Helen McEntee must be rightly worried. Whatever about the job, it's not worth it. It's awful to hear what's happening here now with all the migrants coming from the UK. I'd hate to think what's going to happen here with all our own people around the streets and homeless as well. Now, there is a photograph making the front of the Star today of yet another, you wouldn't call it a village, a tented village, but there are dozens and dozens and dozens of tents again now. All of them blue, so obviously they're provided for people who have nowhere to live. They come in here and they're all in and around the International Protection Order offices in Dublin. It's quite obvious we need to close the border until this issue has been resolved. Ooh, that would be a serious move, closing the border with the North. Get the army up there, Neil, and just close it. It's not rocket science. Another issue that needs to be resolved is all of our top politicians. When they finish the Dáil, they hope to get big, cushy jobs in Europe. Surely be to God there's a conflict of interest. Of course, they wanting a big, cushy job in Europe will pander to the EU, knowing they'll be looked on favourably when the big jobs come. In future, anyone serving in the Dáil should not be allowed to serve in Europe afterwards. Bjorn Martin recently said recently that national sovereignty is an outdated concept. My God, how people didn't pick up on that is unbelievable. He has as much told us that he's now more interested in helping Europe than doing his job for Ireland. The people of Cork should wise up to this. He has no interest in Cork people's welfare. Keep up the work and hold these idiots to account, says an angry listener. There are many more like this. Interestingly, how in the name of God could you actually close the border? I mean, are you suggesting that on every single road and by road and Boreen and main road and secondary road between here and the six counties, you would have what? The army there, the Gardaí there, customs there, closing every single solitary road? Impossible. Just not possible. Anyway, that's just my own thought. Text 086-8104-106. But we do know there's a lot of tension. We do know that 80% of those accessing Ireland from the UK now are coming in from Northern Ireland. We do know that levels of exasperation amongst the Irish is at an all-time high. We have a lot of other chaotic issues going on here that there's a huge lean on with regards to services and what have you. And you may recall the Oireachtas Joint Committee on Justice meeting. I know I played this audio a few days ago, but I want to talk to the independent TD, Michael McNamara, in a moment. This isn't outdated. There's been some more water under the bridge since this clip, but this is he quizzing Helen McEntee. Okay, well, that's an audio clip that clearly is not working. But anyway, I think you know the gist of it. It had to do with the numbers involved, with the amount of people who were coming here, the processing and issues like that, and how many were being sent back or how many were being deported or self-deporting at the time. But anyway, back to the phone lines we go. We're joined by independent TD Michael McNamara, who incidentally is running for Europe in the Ireland South constituency as possibly one of our next MEPs. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Neil.
My apologies, that audio clip didn't play. I have played it before. Things have moved along a bit more since you took task with Helen McEntee, right?
Well, they have moved along a lot. I suppose, firstly, we learned that at the same meeting, it transpired, or Helen McEntee made the claim that 80% of asylum applicants in Ireland were coming from Northern Ireland across the border. That obviously made very big news here in Ireland. It also made big news in the United Kingdom.
Okay, just on that point now, various charities here, including those that look after many people who wish to come here, have said that this is not an accurate figure. These would be NGOs making this point, that you can't prove that is the case. Now, she's pushed back again this morning, saying that she is sure that 80% are coming in from the north, right? That's the latest update there.
Yeah, well, it's difficult to see how she can be sure. I mean, Micheál Martin has also, who's obviously her cabinet colleague, has also cast doubt on the figure. I mean, the figure is based on the number who apply at the International Protection Office, which is that building that's surrounded by tents in Dublin, who apply there rather than at the frontier in at the ports or airports. So everybody else, 80% apply at that office, and she bases that she assumes that they've all come through Northern Ireland. In fairness, I can't see how that can be accurate. It also fails to take account of people who may have come in here clandestinely through other means, maybe through the ports clandestinely, or people who've come here lawfully, and the lawful visa that they have, either a work visa or a holiday visa, is about to expire, and they claim that they claim asylum on the basis that the situation might have changed in their home country and they're afraid to return.
No, I get on that, but the English Times this morning is saying that over half of those who were set to go to Rwanda have gone missing. That would be a figure of maybe over 3,500 of them. Would it be a far stretch to suggest that they went to Northern Ireland and came into the Republic, for instance?
Well, I mean, you can suppose that if you want, but I mean, it's the difficulty, I suppose, or one of the many difficulties, is that people are living sort of underground and moving about, trying to regularise their situation as best they can. So it's very difficult to say with any degree of accuracy. Obviously, NGOs would have contact with people, would represent them, would be meeting with them regularly. So too, I suppose, would immigration lawyers. They may be in a position to give anecdotal evidence. But it's
so we don't know.
Exactly.
We don't know.
We don't know, but I suppose the one thing I'd say, though, about the 80% is, even if it's, you know, 75%, we don't know, though, whether that's a new phenomenon or whether a large proportion of people who claimed asylum here always came through the UK. I mean, we don't have a comparator figure, if you know what I mean. We don't know what it was a year ago or 10 years ago.
But it certainly worked working for the UK, the Rwanda threat, isn't it?
Well, it's certainly working politically for Rishi Sunak's government. I mean, he seized on this, the fact that it was in the media in the UK, and he said, well, that's proof that if 80% of the people are crossing the border, that's proof that my policy is working. Of course, what we don't know is what the figure was 10 years ago.
Okay.
May well have been quite high as well.
Okay, a texter here claims that Micheál Martin recently said that national sovereignty is an outdated concept. You are saying that we as a nation or our government has actually ceded all of our national sovereignty, everything we should be concerned about, everything Brussels.
I haven't quite said that. I said that we're ceding more and more of our sovereignty to Brussels. I mean, when the Irish people voted in the Lisbon Treaty, there was a protocol in that treaty that said that we were opting out of this common asylum area. We were opting out of the justice and home affairs provisions so that we would start to plough our own furrow on that. Now, we were going to do so in conjunction with the UK because the UK had exactly the same opt-out. Now, not alone did they maintain that opt-out, they opted out of the European Union entirely. But this government has said that they're going to opt in to all the latest, or almost.
We're on board for whatever Europe is telling us we must do, right?
Well, it would effectively become one more area of Irish law where the policies are being determined in Brussels rather than in Dublin. I think that there's a lot to be said for European cooperation in some areas, but in migration, we are an island off an island off the mainland of Europe, and maybe what works for the rest of Europe may not work for us because of our geographical position, and we need to maintain that.
Okay. I'm going to ask you how we're going to do that, actually, as an island with a link to another country via Northern Ireland. But I do know that the Irish Times is suggesting that 2024 could see 20,000 international order applicants. That could even be out of date now since the developments of the last few days. And they're saying that in 10 years, there was nearly 11,000 deportation orders in 10 years. And even if you look at the amount for 2023, where 7,300 people were refused status, only 100 have actually left the country. So it isn't working, the process. The application, the appeal and the deportation system is not working, is it?
It's not. No, it's not. I mean, not alone is that not working, but I mean, we have this Dublin system. Ironically, it's called Dublin because the agreement was made in Dublin, whereby EU member states can transfer somebody to have their asylum claim processed in the first country in which they claim asylum or the first country in which they enter the European Union. That's very rarely going to be Ireland because of our geographical location. In 188 cases, it was determined that that 188 people, other countries said that Ireland, yes, we will accept them back from Ireland. It is our duty and it is our responsibility to process those claims. And of course, three were sent back.
Three. I mean,
it does appear that the Department of Justice has a big problem implementing its own system. It seems unable to implement its own system. I don't know why that is. I suspect it's to do with resources. But I mean, the direct people who are in the asylum process are, even after they've finished with the asylum process and they're waiting for a final decision from the minister, they're in direct provision. Obviously, that's a resource that's under pressure. There are more and more and more people applying. There are more and more and more people going into that system. So that means that we need to speed up the processing. That's not to say that it shouldn't be fair and it shouldn't be humane. It absolutely should be fair and humane, but it needs to be faster and it needs to be more efficient. And that may be a matter of resources. But, I mean, we are making millionaires of accommodation providers across the state. So we also need to look at spending some money on processing people so that people are coming out of that system faster.
Okay, so much of the private companies and individuals are making big money from this. The total figure for 2023 for all asylum and refugee costs came in at 2.1 billion euro. That's an awful lot of... It's an enormous amount.
Astounding. It is absolutely astounding. I mean, I've been asking for those figures for going back months now. I mean, the figures are enormous. Vast sums of money are being made.
And in 2022, it was 900 million. How could it go from that to over 900 million, just under 1 billion? How could it over double in the course of two calendar years?
I don't know, but I suppose, you know, the government are entering the market. It's a provider's market. I mean, the people are, I think, in a position. I mean, I live in Clare. The same is true of Kerry, West Cork to a slightly lesser extent, all of the Western Seaboard, where you have hoteliers who are essentially renting out their facilities to the government to accommodate either people who've come from Ukraine or asylum seekers, and they're in a position to effectively charge what they like because of the shortage of accommodation. People do have to be accommodated, but we do need to process people more quickly so that we're not having to accommodate people as long. And also, people's lives are on hold while they're being processed. I mean, people need to know, am I going to be able to stay here lawfully, or am I going to have to return to another country? But that should be a decision that's made much more quickly.
But something has happened in the last 3 or 4 months. The Irish Times this morning is saying that in the first 3 months of 2024, 4,715 people applied for asylum at the IPO office at Mount Street, where all the tents are. So that's 4,700. And 420 made applications at the airport or at a seaport. So where did the over 4,000, where did they come into the country if it wasn't across the border?
No, I mean, as I say, some people may have been in the country lawfully, then their visa runs out and they apply.
Okay.
But for the vast majority, it is across the border. I mean, I'm not disputing the fact that the vast majority are coming from across the border. I just don't know where the exact 80% figure is, a very exact figure, and Micheál Martin's also challenging that.
So where do we go from here? Because the Irish courts have said that you can't send somebody back to the UK with the threat of Rwanda hanging over their head.
It wasn't quite that. I mean, what they said is that there was a technicality around that. The Irish High Court struck down the provision whereby people could be returned to the UK, but the government are not accepting that. They're appealing it to the Supreme Court, but they're also bringing forward emergency legislation to plug the gap in the meantime. But that's been overtaken in any event by Rishi Sunak's announcement that it doesn't really matter what you do domestically, we're not going to take people back because France aren't taking people back. And up to the point that the High Court struck it down, which was on the 22nd of March this year, 2024, nobody had been transferred under that system or under that agreement, and that agreement was made in March 2020 as part of the Brexit stuff, as part of the Brexit agreements. So it's not like this is a major impediment. We never implemented it. The Department of Justice, it's just one more facet of the immigration system that the Department of Justice has not implemented.
How would it be implemented, though? I was trying to unpick that earlier on. If you were to say, okay, we are going to send back many hundreds, perhaps thousands of people in the not too distant future to England. How would that physically happen to make it work?
People would be accompanied by a member of An Garda Síochána to the United Kingdom. Either they would be brought across the border and given and transferred into state authorities across the border, or they would be brought by plane to the United Kingdom, accompanied usually by a GNIB official. That's the
They get to. With the Garda brings them to Belfast, sure the PSNI will just tell them, go on, sling your hook, and they'll just return back to Ireland, or if they go on a plane with a member of An Garda Síochána, they land in Heathrow, Rishi Sunak's given an order, do not accept the returned migrant to the UK.
They may or may not, which goes back to this whole migration pact that Helen McEntee and the government are saying this will solve our problems, but it won't, because if we have an open border with the United Kingdom, which we have and which is very important for this state, that residents of Ireland, north and south, are able to cross that border unimpeded, well, then we have to coordinate our policies with the United Kingdom. It is arguably more important that we coordinate.
They're not interested. Sunak said he's not interested in any agreements, regardless of what we do in courts or in Dáil Éireann.
They're not interested in the run into an election. I mean, that may change, but also the Irish government does have to ensure that a system is put in place and maybe put pressure on France. I mean, we are in the EU now. France is not. It may be that what Sunak is looking for is, I understand, an EU-wide deal that applies to Ireland but equally applies to the rest of the European Union.
Okay, so for this to work for us, France has to play ball with the UK.
That's essentially what Sunak is. I mean, an agreement was made between Ireland and the United Kingdom. One might expect people to live up to agreements they make, but Sunak has announced last week he's taken advantage of the situation that arose in Ireland and has announced that, look, we're not going to play ball with Ireland. We will do a deal with the entirety of the European Union or none at all. That's the position in which we find ourselves. That's the choice he's made in the run into an election. And I suppose, you know, there is little enough that we can do other than talk to our EU. Micheál Martin, that is, I mean, it's certainly not for a lowly independent backbench TD such as me.
No, but you are running as a potential MEP.
I certainly am. I am, and it's something that I would be taking up. I mean, I think that we need to have people, as more and more decisions are being made in Europe, we need to have people that are holding the decision makers and the policy makers in Europe to account on behalf of ordinary people whose lives are affected in Ireland.
Okay, and let's just finally deal with that. 14,000 accessing emergency accommodation in Ireland. They wouldn't necessarily all be Irish people, don't get me wrong, most of them would be. And 4,000 of that 14,000 are children. They're either at home with their parents, some are sleeping in cars, some are sleeping in tents, some are couch surfing, I should say. Everybody seems to forget about them, and an ongoing issue with regards to our health service, problems within our Garda Síochána, housing, homes, cost of living. That seems to be very much on the back burner now, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, I've never forgotten about them. I mean, obviously there was considerable media interest in the Justice Committee last week, but I mean, I've continued to ask questions around our housing policy. In particular, you know, it seems that we have a lot of potential housing. I was in Cork City yesterday going through, and there's a lot of premises where you have a commercial unit on the ground floor. In the upper floors, families were living there for generations. They're largely now empty. That's the same of every town in Cork.
You know why that is, don't you? You know why that is.
Well, it's very difficult to comply with the planning and build regs, and to bring, if you do them up now, you have to bring up to the same standard as a new build.
It's more to do with fire safety and emergency exits.
Absolutely it is. But if you can live safely in accommodation over in medieval premises in Paris or Prague, then I believe it can be done in Cork. I'm not saying it can be done across Ireland. We do need to look at our build regs and our fire regs to ensure that something can be done. It absolutely has to be safe, but we do need to look at what other countries are doing to ensure that people can live in buildings that are already there, that are already built, and that we can get families. And even from a social perspective, it would be much better to have people living in the main streets of our cities and our towns. Yeah. And also from every other perspective, from an environmental perspective even, people aren't driving as far because they're living in the centre of our towns and cities. I appreciate it is to do with fire rigs, but if you can do it safely in Paris, Prague, and every other city across Europe, we can do it safely in Cork and across Ireland.
So, okay, much obliged to you, Independent TD. Michael McNamara, also running for Europe in the Ireland South constituency. Just very quickly, there's a three-car accident on the Ballincollig bypass just before the Bandon Road flyover there. It's causing all of those delays I was talking about earlier on. Traffic is backed up and it's affecting all sorts of commutes this morning. Bear that in mind. Back after 10.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM. Conversation that matters.
Big response. We're into day two of our giveaway for the Metropole Hotel. It's an overnight for two of you with dinner in the Met Bar and Restaurant, followed by a great night's sleep, a delicious breakfast the next morning in the Riverview Restaurant overlooking the River Lee. Serving delicious lunches, really lovely early birds as well at the Metropole, and a super dinner menu 7 days a week. A lot of it's locally sourced seafood and cheeses and meats and fruits and veg and everything. They're doing their bit for Cork and the Metropole. So it's an overnight whenever suits you with dinner and breakfast for you and whomever you choose to take with you. So we're asking people where you met. I will be changing it tomorrow for other people who, for instance, have never met a partner. But for today, we'll continue with this one and we'll mix up the different giveaways across the week. There was a big response to it, so we'll get some more calls on where people met, as in Metropole. Throughout the course of the morning. By text already this morning, one thing that I did mention was the Egyptians who were drinking 10 pints of beer a day as they built the pyramids. And I'm saying those days of having a drink at lunchtime, very common in the UK for years. You go in and you'd have a pint or maybe 2 pints or go back to work. That's well gone now. Mind you, Kathy says, the French have a glass of rosé and go back to work every single day. No problem in that regard. And she also says, when I was talking about the things that you are supposed to replace and throw away, you know, I was mentioned earlier on the shelf life of a towel, for instance, or a shower curtain, or the pots and pans, or the toilet brush, or how often you should change. They say you should, because of all the bacteria and the bad stuff that's on your phone cover, you should change it every 6 months. She says, new phone cover every 6 months is nothing more than marketing to do what? Sell more phone covers. And interestingly, somebody else has picked up on exactly that as well. And I'm happy to read out even the ones that are critical of me. This throwaway mentality is more toxic than the dirt accumulated on the items you read out. Come on. We've only just heard on your program recently how tons of plastic are being dumped into the ocean every second of every day. That is true. Noel goes for it. He says, are you actually seriously reading out irresponsible crap like you did regarding throwing stuff out? Did you not know that fast fashion is destroying the planet? And a broadcaster, first thing in the morning, starts telling us we need to dump our towels after 3 months? Seriously? I take it you're intelligent enough to realize that you didn't think this one through properly, Neil. A lot of stupid people out there will take that irresponsible advice and do exactly that. They will dump perfectly good products, then run out and buy brand new versions of the same products, and 3 months later will dump them again and again and again, says Noel. I can't disagree in any way, shape or form of what you're saying. Absolutely. Fast fashion could be rolled out to other items as well besides clothing or footwear. Maybe I didn't think it through, and I'm not for a moment saying that you should follow this line of logic, that you throw your toilet brush out after 8 weeks. You could always wash it or sterilize it or give it an old blast of bleach or something. The pots and pans after 3 years, I just would not do it. I mean, you think you get a good pot or a good pan or a good casserole dish, why would you ever throw it out? Just mind it, look after it. Phone covers, never gave that a second thought. Shower curtains, don't have one. It's a shower door. Towels, nah. I use towels until they're like wafer thin, me personally, but I'm passing on what the experts are saying, so do bear that in mind. Text 0868104106. Here's an interesting one, and before I get your hopes up, have a listen to this text in its entirety. I wonder, Neil, is there any of your listeners will be interested in a ride in a helicopter? Hands up, hands up, hands up. We need one person to accompany us. We will leave early next Sunday morning from Cork Airport, and we'll fly over Cork, fly over parts of Kerry, and then we will be flying to have lunch at the old Head of Kinsale Golf Club in Kinsale. After that, we will do a flight along the West Cork coast. We'll be flying over the banks of the Lee on the way back to Cork Airport. I was wondering if any of your listeners would be interested in a ride. We need one person to accompany us. If interested, please message. Give out my details. Preferably someone with a helicopter. Otherwise, we can't go.
Call Neil now. 0818-104-106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Okay, we're chatting this morning about some kind of emergency legislation that's going to have to be passed by the Dáil and then, of course, probably signed into law so that it will be possible to send people back who are here illegally, who have had their applications processed and found to be invalid, have appealed and gone through all of that process. And of course, Rishi Sunak is having none of it. That transfer won't work as Britain isn't in the EU anymore. Rishi Sunak is only laughing at the Irish. McEntee should be sacked. She's incompetent. She couldn't run a bath. We have a Father Ted government. Northern Ireland, doesn't it continue to be a pain in the arse for both the Republic and the UK, says Len. Well, they're your thoughts anyway. Micheál Martin is defending the spending of €1 million of taxpayers' money on Ukrainian pets per month. Well, as you said on the air, we have 4,000 homeless Irish children, 14,000 homeless Irish adults, and 1 million people on hospital waiting lists. If that's not the definition of a waster, What is? Morning, I think it's simple. If someone comes into the country, give them a PRSI number and leave them to fend for themselves as soon as possible. At the end of the day, we're all humans, but we really have to stand up and make sure people are vetted. Our jails are full already. Helen McEntee is living in La La Land if she thinks England will take back refugees. So that's the selection, and there are many of them. I'll get some more on the air in a few minutes' time, but back to the phone lines we go. Pick up the phone on 0818 104 106. Jim, good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you, boys?
What do you believe, that we've laid our bed, or made our bed so we need to lie in it, is it, or something like that?
Well, they don't know. I mean, 10 years ago we had this problem, and we've since loads of government since then that haven't dealt with it. 10 years ago we would have said one is enough. No, we know we have enough, but we can't stop it. It's going to keep coming. They won't be able to deal with it. And they're here now, so they're ours. So we have to deal with it. They're not going anywhere. There's only going to be more coming. Even if they meet today, all the emergency legislation cannot work. It will have to go to a court and a judge, and it'll be thrown out. So we're stuck with them. We got to figure out what to do with them. And
but hang on, the law states, the international, or at least the European Union law states, that the responsibility of somebody who's coming, that could be an asylum seeker or a refugee, somebody who's fleeing persecution, not always from persecuted countries, but they come here anyway. But it's their first port of call. Where they land first, that's where responsibility ends.
That's correct, but from what we're concerned about, they came from the UK, and the Irish government have been saying for the last 2 years that the UK is no longer a safe country because of the Rwanda flights. So we made that decision. We took a court decision on that in 2022. So we're now stuck with a court and a government decision. It's our fault. We voted that government in. We allowed them to do it. And remember, you're going down the street, you're going to the pub, if you bring up the conversation, the first thing the fellas next to you would say is, but they're all coming from a terrible country. So we have them now. Let's deal with it. Let's move up in the bed. And let's get on with
it. So we need, but you're actually going to cause absolute chaos, because you're saying we now need to have absolutely no visa applications, no processing of anybody who wishes to come here. You know what the impact will have in the labour market straight away? It would be a race to the bottom for an average weekly, monthly, or yearly salary.
But who does that suit? That suits the employers, and this is the way this country was always built.
No, but you're saying no border controls, no visas, nobody looking for work permits. Just come on in; it's open. So you could be somebody coming from a country which is shockingly bad. You look at maybe a Cambodia or a Thailand or Laos or countries like that, where they might be looking to make $70 to $100 a month.
But then hang on a second, Sinn Féin said this is what it was. Fine Gael said what it was, that this is how it should be. All the NGOs in the country have said this is how it should be. So it's happening, they're coming. So get over the fact about are they coming. They're here, they're going to come in mass numbers.
Okay, so now please tell me how we're going to afford to pay for all of this. Well, certainly with regards to housing or health crisis. Look at any aspect of health, whether it's children, people of an age from 20 to 70, those that are 70 plus, every single cohort of that is affected badly by a crump. If I was saying yesterday, if Ireland were in need of medical intervention, it would be the ICU we should be in as a country. So that's just health, housing, absolutely everything. Yeah.
But you watch the government's answer to every problem. You go forward with a problem to the government, and all they do is tax. The government's answer to everything is tax. They never really come up with solutions. It's just more tax on the worker, and this is what's going to happen here. The government has a big problem now with housing and the refugees coming in. You look at your wage pack this week, because you're going to pay for it. They're going to come up with an idea like a room tax. If you have a house with 5 bedrooms and you're living on your own, you are either going to pay a room tax per room, or you're going to rent those rooms. That's what's coming, whether you like it or not.
How do you know that's coming? Where have you seen any of that? I know there's
they've done that in England years ago. A room tax. You think the Irish government are not going to follow suit?
Sinn Féin government, is it?
Any government will do it. It doesn't matter what government you are. Once you four governments in power, the four of them are responsible for where we are right now.
Well, the one thing that I do know, and I've known it for a long time, as taxpayers in this country, you get absolutely nothing for your taxes paid. Nothing. Everything costs. So,
well, you're going to get less. There's only money will sort this out. The government will annoy us to the point the room tax will come in, and you will have a choice: put someone in or pay the tax. If you're not going to house them, somebody else will. That's what's coming in. But you have an election. Listen, there's an election now in 2 weeks. A local, not 3 weeks, a local election, right? Most people don't even know there's a European election because they're not even talking about that. And people have a choice in 3 or 4 weeks' time. If they elect any member in Cork that's a member of a party, they're crazy. Put in the independents. Just put them in. They can all get together and form a government. This is how it started first day. But if you vote for a sitting politician or the Fianna Fáil, Fianna Gael, the Greens or Sinn Féin, you're basically saying, lads, you're doing a great job. Screw us for another 10 years. That's what you're saying. You have an opportunity in the next local elections to stand up and get this right.
Okay. You don't think that if you have a Dáil full of independents, you will just have absolute roaring and shouting and chaos, no?
Absolutely not. People do it in committee meetings in the local halls. They'd get over it. They can be done. They elect a few people and it's done.
Okay. Text 0868.
Let's face it. You've three parties at the moment that are shouting at each other when you've won. They fall asleep. They do a deal and you've every other member says absolutely nothing. We elect them. They go to Dublin and they shut their head up and they're told what to do because of the whip. It hasn't been good for Ireland. We need to change it. And we have a choice in 3 weeks' time. Do not bloody vote for any of those parties. Put in the independents and let's have a go at this.
Okay.
And they keep telling us a warm walk.
Okay. Thank you, Jim. Text 0868104106. As this migrant situation gets more and more out of control, Europe just keeps blocking every door to help the stalling of helping to change. It seems they have a massive globalization agenda. Even with our European ministers out there, nothing overrides the main players' ideas of this plan, and they are based in Brussels. They recently tried to move the refugees in tents to the Dublin Hills, but they went back to Dublin, moved the International Protection Office to the Dublin Hills, full stop, says Pa. Well, that's where many of those who are here under international protection applications are right now. Even though they did remove the tents some time ago, they're all back again now. They aren't deporting them because they are building houses the length and breadth of the country for them in their tens of thousands. Their families will be next on the planes to Ireland. People need to wake up. The persons allocating the houses needs to be exposed and scrutinised. That is a text that's talking about preferential treatment for houses and services. I now refuse to work for anything related to immigrants or Gardaí, and I've spoken with other tradesmen and they agree. Really? So you're a tradesperson that will do no work in any property related to a migrant or a member of An Garda Síochána, and you said you've spoken to other tradesmen and they agree. That's one of the more bizarre texts that I've heard in a long time. I'd like to know more about that. On what basis are you refusing to work, particularly if it's, you know, clearly, obviously, work you would be paid for? This full stop has to be the worst government in the history of the state. Keep those coming. Text 0868104106 after the break.
Text or WhatsApp Neil now. 0868104106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Michael McGrath saying this morning that it's only a question of time before a politician is hurt. We know of protests outside Roderick O'Gorman's home. We know of issues regarding Helen McEntee and her family home. Interestingly, texter here believes that they were right to protest at Roderick O'Gorman's home. No one likes to see this, but the government isn't listening. Take a look at the people in Newtown Mount Kennedy last week, with their neighbourhood being overrun with illegals all forced upon them. The locals were actually crying. They were very peaceful, but had the Gardaí forcing and dragging them around. The truck drivers that went into the new International Protection Area centres all wore balaclavas. So if you ask me, for protesters, I say well done to them. There are 317 children missing in Ireland. What the hell is the children's minister doing about that? Neil, all things being equal, I would not condone press protesting at politicians' homes. This is following what Michael McGrath was saying this morning. But all things are not equal. Regarding proposed hate speech laws, O'Gorman and his government are happy to send the guards to your home should you say something they deem unacceptable. Yeah, in a nutshell, you're right. It goes to show that you and all of the media are all one-sided. You are all left-wing. You criticise anyone who is not on your side. Here, you said the other morning that O'Gorman's house and other politicians was being protested, but you never said the reasons why. And the reasons the protesters are at politicians' homes because of the children that went missing. Yes, missing. And one of those children was found in a brothel, apparently, 12 months later. Happy to pass that on, clarify that. If those people outside politicians' houses went away and got a job, they wouldn't need time to protest. Nobody has a God-given right to a free house, you know. My God, some people want everything for nothing. They want a free doctor, free school, free house, free travel. If work was free, they'd take that as well. Sometimes I wonder, actually, are the mugs the people that work and get up in the morning and pay huge taxes and have nothing to show for it at the end? But anyway, what do I know? 1, 2, 3, 4. Joanne, good morning. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Nice. Good morning.
Make your point. What was I going to say?
Yeah, I'd just like to say, in my opinion anyway, okay, this is all happening by design. Absolutely happening by design. They're desperate to opt us into the migration pact, right, which is detrimental to our country. So they're going to let this happen now.
Why would they want to let it happen if they're trying to pass emergency legislation this morning to stop it happening?
But that's a waste of time. That's not going to work. The UK will not accept these people back. Mm. They've said so. And this law that they're going to bring in is not worth the papers written on. They want to opt us into this migration pact. So they've let this happen now so that we practically beg to opt into it, which a number of other EU countries are not opting into it.
Okay, so we do know, just on that point, because somebody's asking me this morning, and I'm wondering, is this still relevant? What European countries don't accept refugees? Am I right in saying the Czech Republic, Hungary and Poland?
Hungary, yeah. I think there's another few of them coming on board now, Slovakia.
They've gone rogue in the EU, and they said, no, we do not, on part of this, we're not allowing any relocation. Poland, even, on the border with Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely. But you see, there's different elements to this migration pact, and this is what people need to understand. There's one part of it is called the solidarity mechanism, okay? This is where it's very, very dangerous now for our country and these gumbean politicians that are going to sign us into this that we cannot get out of, right? We'll be allocated a certain amount of refugees every year depending on our GDP, right? So the better our economy is doing, the more we have to take.
Yeah.
If we can't take them because we can't house them, we have to pay €20,000 for every one.
Yeah. Yeah.
For every single one that we can't take. Now, it's obvious we can't take what's on the streets now. So what makes them think we can take more? This is happening by design to sign us into this very dangerous migration pact, and the people need to wake up and see it for what it is.
But again, I'm asking the question, why would politicians from, say, a Taoiseach down to all of the ministerial portfolios, to all of the TDs, to all of the backbenchers, why would they want to vote for something or drive an agenda that's going to cause even more chaos than we already have? What's in it for them?
Because they're the best boys in Europe, Niall, and you should know that more than anyone.
No, but you see, why would they want to do that if they're a TD or a minister who wants to get re-elected? You see, it doesn't make sense.
They don't care anymore. They've gone rogue. They don't care anymore. They're being run by NGOs. We had your man this morning, Henderson, the refugee council.
Yeah, be kind now. Are you referring to Morning Ireland?
Next, Nick Henderson, he said it this morning on the radio, I heard him. We're actively working to get people out of Gaza, refugee status, to get people out of Gaza. Okay? They want this whole country to collapse. That's what they want. They're far left. Far left. They don't believe in borders now. They do not believe
but
in
do
borders.
But do you believe at all that somebody from another country who is poor or destitute is entitled to a new start in a new country if they're willing to get a job, settle down, raise a family and be part of society?
I put it this way, Chair. My own son left in November, right? He had to go through a lengthy process, Garda vetting everything before he could go to Australia.
Yeah.
Do you understand? He's over there now and he's loving it, like all the young people. They're all leaving in their droves. Okay? This is all part of a plan, and people need to wake up and push back. If we sign this pact, this is the detriment of our country. We ain't seen nothing yet.
When you say we ain't seen nothing yet, are you thinking like, say, for instance, John is saying here that civil unrest will follow? This is destined to get worse. Maybe that's why Michael McGrath this morning is saying that sooner or later, if this isn't sorted and people don't calm down and cool the jets, that a politician's going to be hurt or killed.
But listen to me now. I watched the Newtown Mount Kennedy, right? I was watching it for weeks. The riot squad were sent into these people, elderly people, beaten, pepper sprayed, right? Because they want to put migrants into a field, in a field now, in military-style tents, in a little village. They don't have a secondary school. They don't have a guard station. They have nothing. Okay? And then they wonder why the people are angry, so they're sending the riot squad to beat them.
Okay, so we would have issues with...
We need to wake up to the tyranny that we're living in now. Okay. We really need to wake up to it. Monday, there's a march in Dublin. It's time to take our country back now from these globalists.
Steady on now. What is that? What do you mean, take our country back? By what means?
We need to vote them out.
Okay.
We need the local elections. Get out, get registered to vote. We need to vote them out.
Okay. Thanks for that, Joanne. Appreciate it. It's inconceivable but hardly surprising that this country has dilapidated the state it is in now. Much of this, I'd imagine, Joanne would agree with because she's already touched on issues like schools and try and get a GP. Try and get on a GP list. Anyway, Texter says, no GP services, health systems in a shambles, no housing, unless you are fleeing war, of course. Extortionate rents with thousands homeless, not to mention the non-existent mental health services. It's no wonder that the people responsible took off into the sunset. And what do they get? Massive golden handshakes and two or three big pensions. That's a reference, I suppose, to Leo Varadkar. That's a fundamental part of what's wrong with our broken system in this country. If this were a corporate business, you'd be at the very least sacked and possibly prosecuted. But no, their cronies pat them on the back and send them on their merry way. It sickens me to my core to the point where I'm making plans to retire to Spain or the Canaries as soon as is humanly possible for me. Thank you for that. Keep them coming. Text 0868 104, 106. We've got other topics, other emails and other conversations as well between now and midday. Back after the break.
Text or WhatsApp Neil now. 0868 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Text 0868 104 106. I'll come back to that. I promise you I will. But a very disturbing number of emails came in there over the last few days and certainly over the weekend. And if you don't mind, I would like to also deal with them at this point in time. I'm a male, 24 years old. Last September, I was in a pub in the city. I believe I was the victim of a drink spiking at a work event. There was only six of us at the event. We're a close-knit group of work colleagues. We went on a Sunday at 1 p.m., had about three drinks, and we ate. Now, this might have been, I'm just suggesting, it might have been a brunch kind of a do with food and drinks. So 1 p.m., three drinks, and we ate. I'm someone that paces my drinks. The next thing I knew, I was in my bed, and I did not have any feeling at all below my waist. My colleagues filled in the blanks and said I disappeared and was found passed out in the bathroom stall. They got me home, but I have no recollection of any of the events after the lunch, which finished at around 2 p.m. as we had moved tables. My colleagues managed to ring my aunt and drove me home, and I stood bent in the hall, bent in half in the hallway, unable to move. I was told I had to be carried into my bed, three drinks and food. I apparently didn't utter a word, stumble or get sick. My mom said I was like a person who was passed out standing up. With this, my mother said she received a photo of me from in the bathroom off of the bar. When my phone was checked, this photo was not on my phone or in my messages, so it had to have been deleted off my phone by whoever took the photo. I don't quite understand how you actually, your mother got that photograph, but anyway, it was a photograph of you in the bathroom, passed out. Who took the photograph? Why I'm writing to you is because I now have heard of three other people who've had the same experience happen in this particular establishment. Now, the actual establishment isn't named, but it's a city pub, a big bar, probably does food as well. And three other people, same experience. It is not my right to divulge their stories, but after hearing it happen to others, I felt that I had to put this story out there to make people aware that spiking is still very prevalent and indiscriminate. Can I just also mention how I was treated by the staff in the Mercy Hospital? I was brought to the Mercy by my mother and brother when I couldn't feel my legs, and my brother believed I may have been spiked and wanted a blood test done. So we got to the emergency room midnight. Was not seen until 8 a.m. the next morning. I was vomiting the entire 8 hours, and we were not entertained by staff, full stop. My mother eventually asked the security guard what was going on inside, and he said he didn't know, as the beds inside were mainly empty. I say this was around 4 in the morning. I was not seen for another 4 hours, except for initial triage, where my blood pressure was taken. A nurse then told us at 7 a.m. I would not be seen until the change of staff. When I eventually was seen, the nurse forced me out of the wheelchair I was in, despite protests from my mother that I couldn't walk, and she made me walk. I held myself up against the wall with my mum walking into the room I was put into, and we managed to get there. When I got in, I have to say, I was given great care in terms of fluids and finally being able to rest properly. My mother went home for a few hours. Medication was doing its thing and I rested. At this stage, I sent her home, obviously. During this time, I was awake but resting, and I heard the nurses being informed of the patients in the emergency room, where I was mocked and called the guy who came in drunk and can't handle his bubbles, as Prosecco was the drink we had at the event. Despite being told by my mother that it was a potential spiking, they called me the drunk who came in that can't handle his bubbles. I was sent home at 10 a.m. with suspected viral stomach infection. No satisfaction for the staff about spiking. My tests came back negative, but my GP, who I saw the next day, said due to the long wait time in the emergency room, it may have left my system if I was spiked around lunchtime and no tests had been done till 8 a.m. the next morning. I was coherent. I was able to relay what happened when I eventually got to the Mercy. I believe I was spiked, as did my GP. The nurse gave out to me because I did not do a COVID test, etc., etc. Anyway, I had to fight my case. I did not have COVID. I did confirm because I did take a test. Point being, they were trying to push a COVID diagnosis or a COVID test faster than they were as to trying to find actual spiking. Anyway, the end of the email says, if there's any more information you need, let me know. This is an awful thing to happen to anyone, and I just hope my story brings awareness to what's going on in the city. It says James. Now, what's interesting about that is any time that I deal with spiking, and I do not know for a moment how prevalent it is, but any time that we've touched on it with regards to trying to get information or stats from either on Garda Síochána or indeed from the A&Es, they're saying that when they test people for Rohypnol or whatever the spiked product might have been, it's coming back negative. And again, I mean, I'm not second guessing you. You had food and you said you had 3 glasses of Prosecco. You wouldn't think that you'd be the walking dead or a zombie after that. But they again said, now your GP might well be right. Maybe it had left the system and the tests weren't done fast enough. But all too often we hear, certainly from, you know, hospitals, that it's alcohol and it's too much alcohol and it isn't necessarily spiking. But I pass this on because I would like to know, has anybody else had experience of this, or have you stories to share with regards to it? Because you get all sorts of different stories, that sometimes it's punters in the bar do it to somebody, that they want to do it to a girl so that later in the evening they can obviously take advantage. I've heard those stories in the past that sometimes it's a bartender behind the bar that's doing it. So I don't know. It's a slip in a tablet into somebody's drink. Anyway, text 0868104106. Appreciate the email. Thank you. Mark, good morning.
How are things, Neil?
Okay. Never too far from a driving story. And I have more of those again. I want to update with regards to our stolen motorbike as well. But anyway, what have you got for me this morning? Go ahead.
Yeah, so basically Sunday, Neil, I was travelling from Blackpool towards Carrignavar, and I was about 1 kilometre from Carrignavar village when I was going around a sharp bend, and I was driving on the left-hand side of the road, obviously, and just as I was going around the bend, I seen a white Volkswagen Transporter van, and he was coming towards me in my lane. About 3/4 of his van was about to hit me head-on first, so I was obviously able to brake, and I swerved harshly and actually braced myself for an impact. I was sure he was going to hit me, but just as he went past, he just inched my car So I was just in shock in the middle of the road. He was literally inches away from smashing into my door. So, and then I seen that he carried on, and he continued travelling for Blackpool. So I was able to reverse in someone's laneway, and I went behind him trying to, you know, any decent person would, after an incident like that, would say pull in and stop and be like, oh, you okay? But no, these two males anyway continued to drive on towards Blackpool without stopping. So I went behind them. I was flashing them, trying to get them to pull in. It seemed like they didn't even realise what was after happening. And as we travelled on towards Blackpool, down past a Renault truck dealership, MVS, they continued to swerve all over the road. At one point, they were driving on the wrong side of the road. And as I noticed when I was behind them, it was a foreign registration. It was a Bulgarian registration, and there was a black car coming from Blackpool heading in the same direction that I was. They were heading for Cardinavar, and the same van almost hit them head on the right-hand side of the road. And yeah, it was just complete shock, really. And I was on the phone to the guards at this stage, gave them the name or the registration number, the make and model of the vehicle, the colour, everything. The van continued on. We headed down Dublin Hill. The van was still driving erratically, you know, on the wrong side of the road.
When were you in touch with the guards while all this was happening?
Yeah, I was on the phone with the guards from Mayfield Garda Station, just giving them literally live updates as I was driving behind them. You know, I was obviously staying back because I was sure he could have went into the ditch or hit a head-on car. I was at this point, I was still trying to flash him. I was beeping at him, but they didn't even probably realise. They showed no sign that they even realised I was behind them, flashing him, trying to get him to pull in. You know, it was just...
So speeding, weaving, swerving.
Yeah, like fully at one point, obviously we were driving on the left-hand side of the road. Now, at this point, we were coming from, we'll say, the Cardinavar, heading for Blackpool direction, and they were driving on the right-hand side of the road. And later I discovered, obviously, it was a left-hand drive vehicle. It's a Bulgarian registration on the vehicle. So, but yeah, it was just shocking. Speeding, they almost crashed into me first, and then as we passed down heading for Blackpool towards Blackman Pub, they almost crashed into a gentleman driving a black Ford Focus, you know, and they continued down into Blackpool, down into the main street and the whole lot, and it was crazy.
Hmm. Do you get to see the like part of your correspondence with me spoke about tax, NCT, insurance and things. How would you be aware of all of that?
So I actually continued in following the vehicle down through Blackpool, and they went up Assumption Hill into an estate, Ardpatrick, and these two gentlemen that were in the van, they reversed into a driveway. It took them about four or five times to reverse into the driveway. And when we were pulling into the estate as well, there was also an elderly couple, and they seen them kind of struggle to even pull into the estate. You know, and nearly took.
I don't want any more identification than that. So that's fine.
So I obviously went outside the house, pulled up outside the house. I seen these two gentlemen hop out. They didn't really look like a estate to be driving in. They looked worried, like uneasy and unbalanced, whatever. And I waited out. I was still on the phone to the guards at this point. I was waiting for them to come along, and I obviously took a photo of the van, and it's on that photo where you can see there's nothing displayed up on the windscreen of the van. No tax, no insurance.
Okay, have you shared? Have you sent me that? Oh yes, you have. Yeah. Can we enlarge that there? Yeah. Let's have a look at that. Yeah. There's zero documentation on the windscreen of that van.
No, nothing. And you can see there it's not an Irish registration, you know, on the van, and the company livery is on the van as well, you know.
Okay. That's insane.
Yeah, I was just in
complete
shock. That's
insane. Did you get dash cam video?
No, and you see, the thing is, I'd only changed my car the day before, so I was driving a new car, and no, I didn't have, I've no dash cam footage, but like I was talking to the guards, three phone calls I made to the guards. No, they are dealing with the incident.
Oh, listen, I am aware that they are. This is something that they would be very interested in following up on for a lot of.
There's been previous accidents recently on that Balnaina Road where there's been people have lost their lives, and also it was crazy happening in the middle of the day on Sunday.
So, again, not in any way connected. You just mentioned there the sad death of Paul Harrington in his mid-20s, who died when his motorbike was involved in a collision with a van, Ballinahina, 6 o'clock Tuesday. And then the Sunday just gone, you nearly lost your life on the same stretch of road. And again, I'm not connecting two in any way, shape or form, but you're describing of stills of photographs of a van.
Yeah, exactly. Like it was completely insane what had happened, and just in broad daylight, these two males just driving, speeding along the road, driving on the wrong side. Like they were just totally were not in control of the vehicle they were driving, you know.
And you saw them. You're saying, and this of course is what you're saying to me. You saw them get out, and you describe them as unsteady on their feet.
Yeah, exactly. They absolutely, like, even their facial expression, they didn't even realise that I had followed them the whole way from Carrignavar down through Blackpool and whatnot, you know. And like even their driving showed that I'd be shocked if there wasn't anyone down in Blackpool or even down the Dublin Hill area that didn't even see the van, or if there's any footage of the van coming down through that part where I followed them. You know, it was crazy.
Do you see the risk that they're putting on people? You, any other motorist, a family with young children, somebody on a motorbike, somebody on a bicycle, somebody a pedestrian walking.
And I mentioned that when I was on the phone to the authorities, that like there were cyclists around that day. You know, it was 2 o'clock on Sunday. You know, so there were cyclists down in Blackpool when I was following this van. I mentioned that to him, and even for the person driving that Ford Focus, if he is listening to this in any way, shape or form, you know, I'm sure he would agree, because like it was just crazy what I was seeing. First of all, what I seen when I swerved away from the vehicle, the first incident that involved me, and then what I seen unfold in front of me as I continued to follow the vehicle to try get them to stop, you know.
So the Gardaí would have all of this information that you gave, obviously.
Yeah, they do. Yeah,
so that would be an investigation, not unlike the fact that the death of Paul Harrington is also an investigation. He died off his motorbike on the same stretch of road, as I say, some days before you witnessed what you witnessed. And we do know of the death of the Paddy Palmer case, where he lost his life to Bohdan Berversky from Ukraine. He was found guilty of causing the death of Paddy Palmer as well, and there. In his text, he was talking about, consuming large quantities of alcohol. He said he left the scene of an accident drunk in one of the messages he sent to friends after. Are you aware of all of that?
Yeah, I am indeed, yeah. I know the incident.
God almighty, I just... Be interested to see... I'm still even shaking talking
about the incident, you know. It was just... Because obviously, luckily, touch wood, I've never been involved in an incident like that or whatnot. But it was crazy what unfolded, you know.
You didn't approach them or anything. You were just observing, and when they went
I
checked them.
Just in case, you know, you wouldn't know. I was too afraid at that point, because it obviously had come into me. Look, there could be something more sinister about this. Would they have had a weapon, or you wouldn't know what.
You wouldn't know how they were. I know, and I think you were right not to, but nonetheless, I don't know. I don't know whether they're Irish or whether they came here to start a new life. They have a van that's from another country with the livery of a company from another country. They have plates up in it that are from another country. There's no tax. There's no NCT. There's no insurance disc. One can only assume that they're just, and if I'm to believe what you're saying, they were langers, or at least they were certainly unsteady on their feet. That's really giving fingers to everybody, right?
It very much so seemed that way, you know. I obviously can't guarantee it, but like for what unfolded on Sunday at that time, like it would definitely show some signs that was the case.
Okay. Will you stay in touch if maybe the Garda Síochána wish to speak to you or get more information or take a statement or anything like that in the future?
Yeah, 100%
I will. Okay. Stay. I know it sounds like almost a silly thing to say. Stay safe. It's hard to stay safe. Okay. It's not you that need to stay safe. It's the others on the road so that we all stay safe, right?
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
All right, thanks, Mark. Appreciate it. Take care for now. Take care. Meanwhile, text 0868104106. I'll start this, but I know I'll end up coming back after 11, but I want to get an update from Alphonse. He's the blood biker whose bike was stolen by a couple of gougers, has been seen driving all over areas of the north side, particularly up around Apple Computers and that stretch of road there. Motorbike was stolen. I don't know whether he's going to get a claim from insurance or what the story is, but this bike, of course, would have been used because he is, as I say, a voluntary blood biker and moves medical products around, including blood, and moves around quickly on a motorbike. It's much faster for them to do their work. I just wanted to get some updates because we've been in touch. One of the big aspects of this is that if, say, for instance, the Gardaí do see somebody speeding around up on Alphon's motorbike, I think that the law, it's not, I don't know whether it's law, but the guidelines from the Gardaí is that you can't give chase. Is that right, Alphon? They're not allowed to chase them.
Hi, Neil. Yeah, good morning. I was up on the north side there quite a few times over the last couple of days, obviously, trying to see if I could spot my bike, as we've had lots of sightings of the bike up there. And those guys were also, you know, driving erratic on that bike, you know, wrong side of the road, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously, I've been communicating with quite a lot of guards above there as well. And they have pretty much indeed told me that they cannot give chase to the bikes. So even though I'm very grateful for a lot of the sightings and everything we have seen and have been forwarded to me, it seems to me that they're kind of a small bit pointless, because even if the Gardaí spot the bike, you know, they can't stop it, they can't chase it. So those guys are pretty much getting away scot-free, you know.
So if somebody called it in saying, you know, we spotted guys driving like crazy on a bike or in a car or whatever, because you're saying the guards have been told are advised not to chase, because they could be liable, the Gardaí could be liable if there's an accident, and we know of that. We'd certainly know of Gardaí pending prosecutions. That makes tips from the public as useful as a chocolate teapot.
Correct. And to be honest, I think it's fairly sickening. At this stage, I'm actually thinking, starting a petition to get this changed, because obviously I feel, and I'm sure most people would agree, that if you're involved in the chase of your own making, that, you know, I think the outcome of that chase, I think you've pretty much instigated that as the criminal. And I don't see why anybody else should be liable for your mistake at that stage, you know.
We'll pick it up after 11. If you can hold on for me, I just want to finish the conversation with you. Text 0868104106 after 11.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM. Conversation that matters.
It's also day two of our giveaways for the Metropole Hotel. An overnight stay in the Metropole Hotel for two of you. You and whomever you choose to take with you. Check into your room. Dinner in the Met Bar and Restaurant. And then the room. And then, of course, delicious breakfast the next morning in the Riverview Restaurant overlooking the River Lee. In the Met Bar and Restaurant celebrating 127 years in business. And every single year of it, making people happy at the Met. A fine hotel. So that's another one of our giveaways today. And of course, been asking you where you met your loved one, your partner, where you met, as in Metropole. So more of those calls between now and midday. Just want to finish my conversation with Alphonse regarding the bike and the sightings of the bike. I've just been checking there with regards to I don't know whether it's legislation or advice, Alphonse, but when on duty, Gardaí must contact their control room and speak to a dispatcher, a sergeant or an inspector when deciding whether to pursue a suspect vehicle. If permission is granted to the pursuit, the passenger in the Garda car must provide what is a running commentary on the speed, the road condition and whether members of the public are in the area, either on foot or in vehicles. If they are told by dispatchers to desist, they must comply. Can you follow that? I think that's where we're at now. We also recently in 2021 had a Garda who was charged over the death of three burglars in a pursuit. Do you recall that? They crashed and their BMW burst into flames. So that's maybe why Gardaí are slow to pursue.
Very much so. That's the answer I definitely got from the Gardaí that I talked to above there on the north side when I was searching for my bike. And to be fair, you know, it's as I said, you know, Drew Harris, fair play for, you know, doing the 30 minutes high his road policing. It's a great thing to do. But at the same time, you're tying the Gardaí's hands at the same time and asking them to do their job.
Okay, so where is your bike now?
To be honest, your guess at this stage is as good as mine, Neil. I'm assuming it's still somewhere above on the north side. I've been told pretty much by the Gardaí that if I'm lucky, I might get the bike back with damage. If I'm unlucky, they will burn it out in the field in beside Apple. Because once they know that the bike is being looked for, then that's what they tend to do. So there's a very high probability that that bike will be burnt
out. When the bike becomes hot, if you like, it's at that stage. Now, they've taken the plates off your 96 Honda Trans Am, 96D60393. Those plates are gone.
Correct.
So, you may not be able to pursue them, but yeah, I know. You'd have to get a squad car to the area when you know that they're driving and speeding around on the bike, put stingers or roadblocks or something. But that's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, true. And look, I understand why. Do I think that it's right? No, because at this stage, you know, if my insurance decide to honor their policy, yes, I might get some money off back from this bike. But because my bike was parked within 1 kilometer of my house and it was outside on the access road behind my house and it wasn't inside my gate, there's a possibility that the insurance company may not pay out.
That would be a total and utter bummer. But if you have one gouger or two gougers up on the back of that bike and they're driving, it's a fairly nippy bike now, let's be honest about it, but it needs to be, but you drive it responsibly. So you have two up on this and the Gardaí are pursuing them and they both come off the bike and they break their necks or they die. There is potential for the Gardaí in that chase to be charged with the deaths of the two of them.
Correct. And to be honest, I don't think, personally, I don't think that's right. I think, you know, at that stage, you know, you've instigated the outcome of, you know, you're riding on a stolen vehicle. You're riding on a stolen motorbike.
You'd have a fairly smart defence team saying that may be all very well, but you put our clients in danger or, you know, they're now in wheelchairs for the rest of their life, not for stealing the bikes, but for chasing them.
Well, I would think that they put themselves in that danger, Neil.
I know. I'm only saying what they would say. Here's a text from a serving Garda. And let me tell a serving Gardaí that I will never give out personal details or information or numbers of anybody that contacts me. I just will not do it. So the serving Garda said, no Garda will now chase a bike. If the person chased crashes and gets killed, the Garda will be stood down, will be on light duties for anything up to 3 or 4 years, while the slow disciplinary procedure grinds on and on. They also, for all that period of time, have the worry of a criminal prosecution being brought. We only have to look at the Garda that gave a loan of a bike to an elderly person. They had 3 years of stress before their name was cleared, that Garda. It's just not worth a Garda taking any chance at all now. We have both our hands tied behind our backs. That's from a serving Garda.
And I think to me it very much sounds like, you know, we're punishing the wrong people here.
Okay, no, you made that point, yeah, and they put themselves in that position. So have you checked the fields around the tank field and around areas of Holly Hill and areas like that?
We have indeed, and I've had some colleagues go up there with me as well to have a look around. I've actually changed vehicles as well, you know, just to be keep it kind of inconspicuous as I can. We've checked all the fields, all the usual hotspots, and no luck, I'm afraid.
Okay, is there a GoFundMe?
I believe there is. One of my colleagues at work, actually, fair play to him, he put up a GoFundMe for this. I'm not a big fan usually of GoFundMe. You know, I've been in Ireland for about 30 years now, nearly. And I've worked every day that I've been here, and I've paid my taxes, and I'm not a big fan of handouts. I've never been on social welfare or anything like that. You know, I like to pay my own way. So the one thing I'll say is thank you very much for the GoFundMe, and anything is appreciated. But if the bike does come back to me, or the insurance pays out, or whatever, you know, I'll be looking maybe using that money to buy another
equally, you know, equal in value motorcycle.
If the insurance doesn't pay out, or if you don't get the bike back, correct. If the insurance does pay out, or you do get the bike back,
That money will be going straight to Blood Bikes.
Well said, my friend. Do stay in touch. Well, I know I check in with you daily, but there's a lot of interest in the case and the absolute frustration in trying to track down and arrest criminals. But stay in touch, Alphonse, okay?
Will do.
Appreciate it. The GoFundMe is GoFundMe, obviously. Support Alphonse, return to Blood Bike South. Support Alphonse, A-L-F-O-N-S, return to Blood Back South, blank South, as in get him back on a bike doing the life-saving work that he does. Support Alphonse, return to Blood Bike South. Back after the break, text 0868-104-106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
It's indeed be part of the conversations. Breaking news again this morning. The world is in such a very, very dangerous place. This is a story out of the UK where they've got witnesses talking to Sky News regarding a standoff down an alleyway after a man with a sword went on a rampage near a tube station in London. 5 people in hospital, 2 police officers said to be among those attacked, and a 36-year-old has been arrested with a sword and using the sword on innocent members of the public. Text 0868-104-106. Back to the phone lines we go, picking up on some of our conversations earlier on this morning. Peter, good morning.
Morning, Neil.
You're talking about bile racist hatred being engineered throughout the country. I'm interested in your thoughts regarding that.
Yeah, well, Neil, I've never seen such a rise of racist sentiment in this country. I don't know who's behind it or what platform people are getting their information from, but people, I think, are being led to believe that all of their problems are the fault of either violent immigrants or corrupt politicians. I mean, for instance, this talk about the money spent on Ukrainian pets. It might have been on your show last week or the week before. You were talking to some lady who was staying in a hotel in Yale. I didn't quite catch, but I heard the mention of perhaps 700 immigrants being there.
The hotel you're referring to would have a capacity for 700 people.
Maybe that was it. Well, she was asked how many pets were there, and she said, at the moment, there's 3. There's a website called, from the Reuters news agency, Reuters being a very respectable news outlet, and it's called Reuters Fact Check. And if you Google Ukrainian pets in Ireland, Reuters Fact Check, you're brought to this site that says, an image of a fake RT news headline that says the Irish government approved new funding for Ukrainian pet welfare has been shared online, as if it were the top of an authentic article approved by the Irish outlet.
But
the fake screenshot posted on social media was posted last week, uses the RT logo and copies the website's glorified thing, alongside the headline, government signs off on another $150 million allocation for Ukrainian pet welfare.
That's nonsense. That is total and utter nonsense. That's inaccurate. That's fake news. Can I just say, I asked the Ukrainian from the point of view of fact-checking. That's why I asked her, in that hotel where there are many, many hundreds, how many dogs or cats have you actually seen? And she said 3, perhaps 4. Because I don't know. Like the government has never ever denied that it's €1 million allocation per month for Ukrainian pets. I'm just trying to endeavour as to where all the pets are.
Well, that has long stopped. This article goes on to say that's it's a stop paying for pet friendly accommodation arrives in November 2022. But like, what I wonder is who's behind this, Neil, and why? Because I mean, I have friends of mine who are taking these views now, and they're quoting these figures and saying, "Look at all the homeless in Ireland, and we're paying for their pets." That's a kind of a cliche at the moment.
But that figure was never denied. That's the money that was spent. I mean, that's a fact.
Well, it was initially 800,000, but that wasn't denied. But that has since stopped. You know, but like, and this is being led to believe that there's more. I mean, they're showing in the article they're talking about, they're showing a dog swimming in a hotel pool. And so I'm saying, look
how. That's not more nonsense.
My concern is who is behind this and why? I mean, people are being led to believe that I mean, you know, there's signs up there saying hang the politicians high, and people are being led to believe that it's either corrupt politicians or as if all immigrants have violent tendencies or potentially. I don't know. All I'm saying, Neil, is that
on April 11th of this year, the Taoiseach, Micheál Martin, defended the state paying up to €1 million a month for the transportation and accommodation of pets from Ukraine. That's from the Irish Times. I don't know whether you would regard that as being a credible source, where the Taoiseach defended the spending of €1 million. You see,
Well, a figure of 800 million was being bandied.
No, 800,000.
12 million.
800,000, not 800 million.
Okay.
Come on.
Okay. But, okay. But in any event, there is...
No, but you need to be accurate about it. Like, it was never... You won't find anywhere.
800,000. All I'm saying is if you look out this recent article now that's suggesting another 150 million has been approved... and it's using the RTE logo on that. It's fake news.
But I can't account for the world of social media.
I'm not asking you to account for it. No, I'm saying it's existing, and it's existing on a wide scale, and it's being engineered by whom I don't know. But the idea is to pollute the minds of Irish people towards immigrants here.
I don't feel comfortable of talking about people as if they're kind of a commodity that needs to be exported back to the UK, or the UK exporting them like cattle to Rwanda. That's disgusting. I think the problem though is the cost involved in this, and that there seems to be no plan to be able to justify how much more needs to be spent and for how long, with a health service in chaos, with an education system and the strains on that, houses, doctors, GPs, all of the different aspects that it's affecting Ireland as a country because of.
Well, the health service was in chaos anyway before the war in Ukraine started, and there were difficulties back then with GPs too. So to link the two of them, I don't particularly agree with. But no, certainly there is a problem. And it has evolved over the last few years with the number of immigrants in this country. What do we do? But to go about it in this manner, suggesting that they're the cause of various problems and that the Irish government are all corrupt and are behind it. We should be out looking to hang the corrupt politicians. No, there is something sinister going on social media. I don't know who's behind it, but I would certainly like to call it out.
Well, you know, we have this term far right in the worst extremes of society. Somebody calling out for somebody to be hanged. That clearly is hate speech. That should be prosecutable. That is a threat to life, particularly if they mention somebody. But I'm a bit bothered by everybody who has an opinion on access to Ireland through our borders and the cost of it. I think they are entitled to have an opinion, and they are entitled to be critical without being labelled far right.
I'm not labelling anybody far right. I mean, I have concerns about the number of immigrants that are moving here now, for sure. But what do we do with it? How do we treat these people? We have to come. I mean, it's obviously not working the way it is. But at the same time, you know, to be stirring up, to be blaming these people as the cause of our problems.
But certainly putting very serious pressure on Ireland as a nation in all of the different areas that I've already mentioned. I mean, the issue, and even Leo Varadkar has said words to the effect of that we cannot just allow economic tourism or people coming here without proper applications or visas or documentation to back up their claim for a new life, to settle down here, to hopefully work here. Yeah. You have, I mean, anybody that's ever gone abroad, me included, to Canada, I had to get landed immigrancy, visa checks, I had to lodge money in a Canadian bank account. Same as applying to people going to Australia, as an example, or America. None of those rules apply now in Ireland in 2024. That's got to be a worry.
Oh, no. And it is, and it looks like it is being addressed. But to link immigration and immigrants in this country with the cause of a lot of our woes, I don't agree with.
Yes,
I think we had those problems prior to all of this. And I would say, however it will be resolved, I'd say we'll have them after all of this, you know.
Okay.
And I honestly don't think that this notion that all politicians are corrupt. I mean, I rarely vote myself. I'm often of the idea that don't vote, it only encourages them. But at the same time, to suggest that they're in the hands of Brussels and are corrupt and putting those interests at heart, I wouldn't agree.
But are you entitled to any voice at all with regards to our stature of politicians if you yourself don't vote? Does that not deny you of your right to even have an opinion on them?
Well, the problem is, it's just that I certainly would vote if I found somebody, if I thought there was somebody worth voting for. Mm-hmm. And there are some now in my area. I mean, I did vote in the last election.
Okay.
That was the first.
Well, you do vote then. Okay, thank you, Peter. Text 0868104106. Pick up the phone on 0818104106. And there are many texts on this and lots of other topics this morning. Send them back to the UK or their original country. It would cost less in the long run. We already spend a million a month on pets for Ukraine. Actually, that's the problem. If you have people here who aren't supposed to be here or haven't come through the proper channels or processing, you can't send them back to the UK because the UK won't accept them. Rishi Sunak has said he's not interested in dealing with the Irish problem. Much of this is because of the issues he has with the French, who won't deal with his problem when he asks the French to take back those who have come across the channel. Anyway, with all of these scandalous immigration revelations that the so-called far right have been shouting about for years, with these revelations finally coming to light, we must not forget that all of this was happening while Helen McEntee was implementing her amnesty for all policy. Is the penny starting to drop yet? Harris stated 2 days ago, in relation to the border crossings, that every country is entitled to have its own migration policy, but I certainly don't intend to allow anyone else's migration policy to affect the integrity of my own, as in Ireland. So, Texter says, if he is speaking sincerely about that, then why is he opting Ireland into the migrant EU policy? Remember, once we're in, we can't opt out. And one final one. God help Ireland if we have to depend on Micheál Martin to represent the best intentions of the Irish people in Europe rather than his own. Speaking in the Dáil, he said that sovereignty is an outdated concept and now he wants to put our soldiers under the control of the Europeans to fight wars for them. We all know how that worked out for Irishmen when we were ruled by the British. And there's just reams of these. Back after the break.
Call Neil now. 0818 104 106.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Just on the Wilton Road, there was a black car in traffic with five young fellas in it. They were spitting water out of bottles out the windows and banging the side of their car to distract a learner driver in the lane next to them. You'd wonder then, wouldn't you, why we have so many accidents on the roads. It's unbelievable. Just a carload of dopes. Interestingly, another text from a serving Garda says, I'm a serving Garda for 25 years service and I advise all younger members of An Garda Síochána, think before you act because there's a real chance it's the guard who will be prosecuted and vilified in the press and the courts. So why bother doing your job properly? Sit back, relax, take your pay every week when you're not being supported by management or the justice system. So you have Gardaí who want to be Gardaí and get on with dealing with crime, but yet they could have a GSOC investigation hanging over their heads for years for trying to do their job. And is any wonder that they have to play safe these days in the event of them actually becoming the actual criminal rather than those they're trying to catch? I mean, it's absolute nuts. It's insane. It really is. Anyway, we'll pick up on that and lots more again tomorrow. So do keep those texts coming and there are those calls. And do remember the first day of May tomorrow. So that's going to be kicking in with our Live at the Marquee ticket giveaways for the season. And the first gig out of the blocks is later in the month of May, the Sugar Babes. So May alone has the Sugar Babes, the Coronas, Gavin James and Van Morrison, and then into June, all of the others right up to the back end of June. So I've got tickets to give away for all of those gigs for the best calls on air. So think about that if you want to win tickets for Live at the Marquee. But right now, it is day two of our giveaways for the Metropole Hotel, the Met Bar and Restaurant, 127 years in business. It's an overnight stay in the Metropole for two with dinner in the Met Bar and Restaurant. Overnight stay, beautiful room. And then breakfast the next morning in the Riverview Restaurant overlooking the River Lee. So for yesterday and indeed today and possibly tomorrow, we're asking people, as in the Met, where you met your partner or your loved one. And we're getting a massive amount of texts on that, but it's always better to speak to people on air. So let me do that. Laura Crowley Dowling, good morning.
Hi, how are you, Neil?
Okay, so good, thank you, and I hope you're well. So the best call this morning, I will win the overnight. So share your own story, if you will.
So my husband's from Cork, I'm from Dublin, and he travelled to Dublin for work. And he befriended my brothers, but our paths never crossed while he was friends with my brothers. And I actually got engaged to somebody else, and I was having my engagement party. But the man that I was engaged to at the time didn't think it was appropriate for ladies to drink pints or bottles of beer. So he thought I should drink red wine.
Why?
He just didn't think it was ladylike, shall we say.
And did you abide by his belief?
I wasn't impressed, but I went along with it for the engagement party. So I was swanning around with my glass of red wine, which I don't particularly like.
God, Laura. Very sorry now that that happened. A glass of beer? A glass of beer allowed?
No. Only red wine.
Okay.
Which me personally, I don't like. I know some people do. I don't. So I was there with my glass of red wine, and Paddy, my now husband, walked into the bar, and I recognised him from being my brother's friend. Didn't know him, but I recognised him. So he was standing at the bar having a pint, and I walked up beside him and I said to him, Paddy, you wouldn't ever buy us a pint, will you please? I'm not supposed to be drinking pints. Would you please get me a pint? And he did. But we had this wonderful conversation, and I ended up standing with him for a good, I'd say, 45 minutes. We had a couple of pints together until, as Paddy told me after, he could feel the eyeballs burning into the back of his head, with everyone at the party obviously staring at us like, why was I standing at the bar with Paddy when I should have been with my
fiancé?
Oh, so Paddy made a quick exit.
Oh my God.
He didn't want to land himself in trouble, so he made a quick exit, and lo and behold, that night at the end of the party, me and my then fiancé went back to my mum and dad's house, and a big argument ensued over my behaviour at the engagement party, and we split up.
Okay, so what was the argument about? Was it about Paddy and having a long, long chat with him, or was it the drinking pints?
It was Paddy and the long, long chat, and how I had disrespected my fiancé by spending so much time talking to Paddy.
So why didn't he had a pint?
Well, you know, not that I wasn't allowed to speak to other people, but like at an engagement party, you're kind of supposed to be on the arm of your fiancé, not chatting to another lad at the bar.
Okay, so why didn't your fiancé at the time come up to you at the bar and join in the conversation? Say, who's this? How are you? I'm such and such.
Let's just say he wasn't that type of person.
Okay. Yeah. That whole business, he didn't ask you not to drink pints. He said he didn't want you drinking pints. That's a red flag. That's a red flag to me.
Oh, I definitely dodged a bullet. He was very opinionated about how I should dress and look and what I should drink. And yeah. So in hindsight, I definitely dodged a big, big bullet there.
Were you in love with him?
I was. Well, I thought I was, I suppose. I was, yeah.
Okay. In spite of all of that kind of control, sort of, you still found aspects of him attractable and likable.
It kind of seeped in very slowly. Like when we were just going out, he wasn't like that at all. It was only when the ring went on the finger, then little things started to change. And even my mother noticed it. And, you know, I wasn't going out with my friends anymore. And I wasn't doing this anymore. And, you know, it just slowly, slowly creeped in.
Right. And on that night then, did you break it off?
I did. I threw the ring back at him.
Did you?
I did, yeah.
Did you regret that, or were you relieved, or what?
I was very relieved, because I think it was like I woke up and I realised, hang on, this isn't the way I want to spend the rest of my life, being told, you know, how to act and look and that kind of thing. So I was very relieved the next morning, but I was massively embarrassed. Like, I was so embarrassed. I thought everyone was talking about me. So I hid away from everyone for a few months. I wouldn't go out. I'd literally go to work, come home, go to work, come home, and I wouldn't leave the house.
But like, people contacting you by mobile phone, texting your friends, ringing you, wondering what's going on?
Oh yeah, everyone was trying to, like, I have two brothers who I'd be very close with, and they were trying to get me to come out. They were like, come on, we'll go for a drink, or come on, we'll go out. And my friends were ringing, saying, come on, we'll go to the cinema. I was, no, not going out, and I'm too embarrassed, I'm too humiliated, no, not going out. So I kind of hid away for a few months.
Okay, and after a few months, were you feeling a bit more confident, or what?
I did. So a really good friend of mine at the time, she came in and she said to me, Laura, come on, we're going out. It was St. Patrick's night. And said, Laura, we're going out. You love St. Patrick's Day. Enough of this hiding away. You're going out. So I said, fine. So we went out and she was giving me a pep talk as to, you know, you need to move on and you need to get on with your life and you need to do this and da 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 da. And we finished our drink and we were leaving to go to a different pub for a drink. And who walked up the stairs? Only Paddy.
On that night?
On that night. And I saw him and I just looked and it was like a light bulb moment. It was like, Paddy. So we had a big hug and then we ended up, him, Paddy and myself and my friend ended up spending the evening together having drinks. And we swapped numbers. And that night I rang him and told him I fancied him. And we went on a date the next morning, or the next day.
You rang him and said, I fancy you.
I did. Yeah.
You weren't hanging around then, were you?
No. I wasn't letting him go.
Was he, forgive me for the 20 questions, but it's intriguing. Was he aware of the ex and the telling you what you should and shouldn't wear and what you should and shouldn't drink?
He was aware of the ex, but he didn't know of the behaviour from the ex. Like, he knew that we'd split up that night because he met my brothers for a drink, say, the day after the engagement party. And my brothers were like, oh, Laura threw the ring at your man and engagement's over. And Paddy was like, what?
Was Paddy thinking, that's all my fault?
Yeah.
What a story. Oh, my God.
So, yeah, we went for a drink then. I rang him that night and we went for a drink the next day and we went for a few dates and 11 months later we got engaged. We got married 2 years after that and now we're married, 15 years with 5 beautiful children.
Where are you living?
We live in Bantry in West Cork.
Smart girl, you legged it out of Dublin down to beautiful West Cork.
Absolutely, I got out of Dublin as quick as I could.
So there's no chance of bumping into the ex-fiancé down there then, I suppose.
No, God, no. No.
Oh, no. My God. I mean, no, this it's a lot of fun, my chat with you, but there is a serious aspect to it, and that is forms of coercive control, and that is awful.
Oh, absolutely.
It really and truly is.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Boy, must have come as a great relief to you that you got out of that one and met the man of your dreams who treats you with respect. And that's a wonderful
absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You're wonderful.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Great story. Great story. Thanks, Laura. Stay listening. Hang in there. Thanks for now. That would be a tough one to beat. Let me get some more calls on the air this side of midday. Angela.
Good morning.
Okay, so overnights in the Metropolitan Hotel. Where are you calling from?
At the moment, I'm down in Inchidani. Wait, let's get the marbles out of my mouth now first. I'm in the Inchidani Island Hotel and Spa.
Oh, very posh.
Excuse me.
Very posh.
I'm from Passage West.
You're on a little breakdown at the Inchidani Hotel and Spa. I love it.
Yes, it's our wedding anniversary on the 2nd of next Thursday.
That's good. So will you be down there for that as well?
That's why we came down for 54 years married.
And where did you meet Paddy?
A group of people used to run buses to different areas in the city and the county. And there was a bus used to come down from the Grand Parade down as far as around the Skiddy. And a load of lads from Ballyfihan and places like that would get on the bus and would stop in Douglas and Passage and bring us all around the Skiddy to a community hall. And
in 1968.
Yes, and the band, in those days, the boys would stand at one side and the girls would stand at the other side.
Yeah.
and they'd wait for the boys to ask him to dance. And some of the girls then would say, the lad would say, "Are you dancing?" "No, I'm holding down the floorboards. What do you think I'm doing?" then they'd go away. So I went up, I saw this chap over in the corner.
Little chap.
Very quiet now.
Little chap.
Well, he wasn't. Do you know now he was sitting down and he was very quiet. And all the lads were rolled like, but he was very quiet. And I said, "He's quite a little creature, isn't he?" So I went up to the band and I said to your man, "Can you play a lady's choice?" So he said, that was when the ladies were allowed to ask the men. So I spotted Paddy over in the corner like, and I made a beeline.
Here we go again now, women having to ask permission for something. You had to ask permission to be able to ask a fella out to dance, because otherwise you had to wait all night till the man asked. What?
I would have asked him anyway.
Oh yeah, well, I like a rule breaker. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, so before he announced it, only edged my way towards Paddy like in case anybody would nab him. And I said, "Would you like to dance?" He said, "I would." I said, "Would you like to be more enthusiastic?" "Would you say I'd love to dance with you?" "I will." So I said, "To dance with you." So we went up on the floor and it was a lovely time. And we went for about that. In those days, they said, "Do you want to go for a bottle of orange?" That was kind of get off, would you like?
That was cold.
So we went for a bottle of orange and we got the bus home together from Ringaskiddy. And he said to me, "Can I meet you tomorrow night?" And I said, "Actually, I can't." Now, this is a scream because my mother and father never went over to an anniversary in their life. I said, "I can't go tomorrow night because my mum and dad are having an anniversary," which was in January. And I said, "My mum and dad are having an anniversary and they're going out. So it's mine, my two brothers, John and Michael." So he said, "Okay, then maybe Sunday." I said, "Yeah, I'll meet if you want to get off the bus at the Club Hotel in Glenbrook."
So, I remember the Club Hotel. There was a good disco there. Yeah.
So I used to go up with a friend of mine, Antoinette Fitzgerald. We used to go to Majorca every Saturday night. So I got all dolled up Saturday night, myself and Antoinette. Oh, we go down to Majorca. I'm standing down the Majorca and this fella comes over. "Do you want to dance?" I said, "Oh, really? I wouldn't mind." So I went dancing with him and he was chatting to him to do something. And I said, "Good luck." So Sunday night I goes down to meet Paddy off the bus and he's desperately quiet, so he says to me, "How did your mum and dad's anniversary go?" I said, "Great, they had a great night, they're very united. This time now they'd kill each other." He says, "That's funny." He said, "My brother said he met you and danced you last night in the Majorca."
"Ah, that was my twin sister."
I said, "What do you mean, love?" He said, "My brother said he met you and gave you a dance." Well, I said, "Paddy, you mightn't have turned up tonight." I said, "I go every Saturday night with my friend in Majorca." I said, "I couldn't just leave her sitting there." And actually, I understand that. Never mentioned it again. Off we went up to the pictures in the town hall.
He was a very tolerant, understanding young man. Because he could equally have said, "Well, you should have told me the truth anyway." I'd have gone for the twin sister line myself, to be honest, Angela.
"I know you haven't met me, there's not two of me, love."
Well, they've met you down in the Inchidonny. I'm sure they know all about you now. So,
I come down here.
Where did the elopement come from then?
The elopement came from genuine and sincerity. We were going out together so long, like any red-blooded man, he wanted his oats, and I said, "No, not until we get married." Now,
That was the way back in the 60s, yeah, absolutely.
Came home and said to my dad, "Paddy and I were thinking of getting married." I said, "Paddy and I were wondering when we could get married." And he looked at me.
How old were you?
Again, 17. He looked at me and he said, "You made your bed, you can lie on it." And I got the message done, like. So
you got permission. It's all permission for the women back then.
No. So we got married on a bank holiday May weekend.
Your dad thought you were pregnant, did he?
He was certain, and you couldn't blame him, but he could have given me the benefit of the doubt.
He didn't, though. You made your bed.
He didn't.
Yeah.
And then when I had my baby then on the 17th of March, I went down to the house, I gave him the birth cert and the marriage cert. I said, "Dad, could you make up the dates on that, love?" I said, "Because you're great now at a math." So he says, 10 and a half months. dead. I said, that's a miracle. He said, what do you mean, girl? I said, I was pregnant for 10 and a half months, Luke. He was absolutely livid. He was absolutely livid.
Doubting his daughter like that.
But you see, you could understand, but in those days, people did get married at 17. They never worried about where they lived. We lived in a three-story apartment in Victoria Avenue. We went into Roach's Stores and we got a bid for 153 euros on her purchase. And there was a couch and a bed. It was a bed city. And we had to leave it down at night and put all the blankets away.
I know, sure, it's all changed.
In the morning.
Yeah.
We had nothing. And we do something. When we got a house in Mayfield, we had to get a coat around the ESB. When that was paid then, we had to go for the fridge. That was paid, we had to go for the washing machine.
Yeah.
God damn it.
And you look at it now, say, how many years later, now 54 years later, where by and large, new homes are completely kitted out. Flooring, white goods, brown goods, television,
and
beds, carpets.
I know.
And it's wonderful that we've come this far.
But the marriages don't last when everything is handed to them. They don't have to work for it.
You married your childhood sweetheart 54 years ago this coming Thursday.
This coming Thursday. And for our honeymoon, 3 months after we got married, the August weekend, we went to Dublin on a 150.
What'd you do with your clothes? Where'd you put the clothes? Where'd you put your suitcase?
A knapsack. Suitcase. We didn't have clothes in those days, only what we stood in.
150 to Dublin for your honeymoon. For how long? A week, is it?
I drove a weekend. I drove as far as Buttervent. We stopped with petrol and we had to wait for the garage to open on a bank holiday weekend. And then we drove the whole way to Dublin up to my cousin from Van Mullins. And we went.
What did you do in Dublin? Did you go to the zoo or what did you do?
We went to the zoo and we were taking photographs and the swan tried to bite Paddy. Jesus Christ, he's biting me, Paddy says to me. I said, what the swans? You know the swans in Dublin Zoo by the lake?
Yeah.
They tried to bite Paddy. I said, stay forward quick.
I have to go because I want to talk to Christine before I lose any more time or go run out of time.
But it's nice talking to you.
Hang on a second. Like, I can understand you at the zoo and everything. You were only 17.
Yeah.
You're kids, like, sweet, childhood,
you know,
sweethearts.
We grew up together, thank God. We reared our kids in the same era as ourselves.
That's a great story. That's a great story. Listen, stay listening, Angela, and happy anniversary for Thursday down at the Inchidani Hotel and Spa. Can I get one more? Yeah, I'll do my best. Christine, good morning.
Good morning, Neil. How are you?
I'm good. Can you just hold on there and I'll just finish up with you after the break? You all right? 2 seconds, won't be long.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.
And so, Christine, thanks for holding. You met the man of your life and celebrate your 30th wedding anniversary this coming June on an aeroplane to Gran Canaria. Is that right?
That is right. Yeah. I'm originally from Dublin. My husband's from Cork. And I'm going with friends for my birthday celebrations. And we're on the plane. It was a late flight, so imagine. And
just move around a little bit there, Christine. And while you are, was it a 21st birthday, your 18th, or what was it?
No. It was just a normal 20-something birthday.
All right, okay.
And nothing special. And it was just an annual holiday to go with my friends. And as I said, I knew one day, hostess, and she went up to the pilot to say to announce it that it was a special birthday on board. And of course, this man jumped up and I told him to sit the F down. It was my birthday, not his.
When he jumped up and said, it's my birthday as well.
He said, it's my birthday too. And I went, no, I said, it's mine. And so we did a bit of banter on the plane and we got off the plane anyway and we ended up seeing the apartment block.
The same, yes, you're breaking up. You ended up getting...
Sorry.
You were in the same apartment block.
We were staying in the same apartment block and that was grand. There was four women and he was with his friend, male friend, so I thought he was that was his partner at the time. And I was wondering, like, I said, these couple are very weird, and they kept, everywhere we went, they were there. So one night, we went for a night out, you know, and we got a bus out, and everybody, we were having great fun. I turned around, everybody's gone home, and just left the two of us sitting there. So it sort of escalated from there on. We got to know each other, and of course, we had to come back. I had to come back to Dublin, and he had to go back to Cork. And then I remember coming home, and I said, I'll only go out with you if you bring me to the All-Ireland final in Dublin and in Crow Park. And he got me a ticket, and I never was into GAA whatsoever. So that was grand.
So why did you want to go? I mean, who was playing?
My father said if he was a true man, Cork was playing, Cork and Down.
Okay. So if he truly loves you, he'll get you tickets.
If he truly loves me, he'd bring me to the match. And I related in Cork, and they were all up going to the match and everything, and up in Dublin. And I said, so he turned up at the door with the ticket. So I said, grand. That was it. So we celebrated. And, well, we didn't win that match, obviously, down one, but we celebrated ourselves, the big gang of us. So Aslan were playing the following week, and he was playing our local pub. So he got down on one knee in front of Aslan the following week, and he asked me to marry him.
Wow, that was fast, wasn't it?
It was fast and stuff, yeah, and it was actually embarrassing at the time. So we officially got engaged in December, but he asked me in front of 50 and it was 50 women.
No, you're breaking up again. You said it was embarrassing. Sorry. For why? Why was it embarrassing?
It was embarrassing, like in front of all these people.
Did he propose in public?
Yes, it was at a gig. It was an Aslan gig down at a local pub in Dublin, and I used to go and watch them every so often. So I sort of knew Christy from that.
It's kind of, yeah. I mean, I know people do. Some people might find it mortifying, or they could pick a better occasion, or maybe something a little bit romantic.
Yeah, well, it was romantic. So we got officially engaged in December, and the following week, my bag was taken, and I can't say anything there, but my birth control was taken, and I ended up getting pregnant.
Who took your birth control?
My handbag was stolen on the bus.
By a burglar, is it?
But yeah, I was coming out of work. I used to work in Sisters, and I was somebody following me, but unknown to me. I didn't think. And next minute, I turned around, the bag is gone.
Oh my! No, that is serious, obviously. But are you kind of blaming the burglar for the pregnancy?
No, but I pinned him out in the bus, and I told him to give me back my bag, and he totally blanked me. But anyway. It happened for a good reason, because we ended up getting married the following June. And we got married during the World Cup, and it was absolutely, Ireland were playing the next day, and it was absolutely the best.
And 30 years later, come June 17th,
four grandchildren. Yeah, dog, and, cat, 10.
So dog, cat, four children, four grandchildren, and not the slightest trace of a Dublin accent left in you.
No, God, no, no. I lost that when I came down. It comes out the odd time now. You know, the odd time.
Okay. All right, listen, great story. Thanks for sharing. I love the way people can tell their tales. Just one quick text here. My partner literally walked in my front door to me. My marriage broke down. I moved back to Wilton to be closer to my family with four small kids, now all grown up. And I realized my next door neighbor was a friend of my husband's. He was much older than me, but he would call in for a coffee. One day he asked if I met the new guy in his house share, and I said no. He came in the same evening to meet me, and we hit it off straight away. He literally walked through my front door. The rest is history. My mother used to say, if you don't go out, you'll never meet somebody. Nobody will ever walk in your front door, you know. And I used to say, you never know. The postman or the DHL driver might be good looking. And lo and behold, in he walked. 14 years later, and the honeymoon period hasn't ended yet. I will read out some more texts because they really are great fun. But I need to pick a winner. The Met Barn Restaurant. It's an overnight for two with dinner at the Met Barn Restaurant and a delicious breakfast the following morning in the Riverview Restaurant. Thank you to everybody that's texted. I'll read out loads more of them tomorrow, and calls as well. Thank you to Christine and to Angela and to Laura Crowley Dowling, who met her husband at her engagement party, ditched her fiancé for her now husband and told a great story, really and truly. So for Laura Crowley Dowling, we've got an overnight for you and your hubby, whose name I forget. My apologies for that. But you know who he is. That's all that matters. Paddy, wasn't it? Yeah, Paddy. So for Paddy and for Laura, an overnight in the Metropole Hotel. We'll do it again tomorrow. That and lots more besides. Text 0868 104 106. Pick up the phone on 0818 104 106, and you can always bang me off an email. Love the emails, me, neil@redfm.ie. Have a good day. I'll see you tomorrow.
The Neil Prendeville Show on Red FM.
Conversation that matters.